Ah, much better. It's the Sound Off Christmas Show.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You're like fighting a woman?
Your behavior just hasn't been very oozy.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me!
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it. It's one of those years where the Christmas show actually falls on Christmas. Merry Christmas to all who are celebrating this weekend. I hope Santa got you what you wanted. No Michael Cole in your stocking. Santa Solo Monster has brought you a brand new episode of The Sound Off. This is episode 788 for Sunday, December 25th, 2022. Even when WWE goes to a best of clip show tomorrow, you get a brand new episode of The Sound Off. Not a lot of news to talk about. I will be addressing the whole Miro situation with AEW, which has become something of a mess. Bronson Reed, back in WWE. I have some thoughts on Tuesday's NXT show. And the main event for this week. My ranking of the 15 best matches of the year, as well as my annual year-end awards. We're going to do Wrestler of the Year. We're going to do Tag Team of the Year. Best and Worst Show of the Year. Rookie of the Year. Most Improved. And the Biggest Stories of 2022. There were so many crazy ones, I had forgotten some of them until I went back through my notes and all the different stories that I covered this year. It's just the wildest year in all the years I've been a wrestling fan. And that is a very long time. You know who isn't having a very Merry Christmas today? Dominic Mysterio. First, we got a Thanksgiving video from the Mysterio house with Dom and Rhea beating up Rey. This time, we got a video with Dominic and Rhea showing up to the Mysterio family Christmas party at his grandparents' house. It was so wholesome seeing Dom's grandpa embracing his new goth girlfriend when they first showed up on their doorstep. Rey told his son he wasn't doing this again. Why don't you step outside? I'll meet you outside. He had his mask on again, too. He's very committed to keeping kayfabe. Dominic shoved Rey. His mother raised her hand to go hit him, but Rhea grabbed it and stopped her. And then Angie slapped Rhea. Lucky for them, the police happened to show up at that very moment before things could escalate. And they arrested Dominic, who gave us some gems like, "My mom hit mommy. Mommy, bail me out, and I won't make it in jail." Not with that mullet, he won't. I just kept saying that over and over. "I won't make it in jail. Call Finn and Priest. I won't make it in jail." As Rhea yelled at the cops and they drove off, Rhea tweeted that Christmas is canceled. If it was any other week, I would say that he would be bailed out by Raw tomorrow, but there is no Raw this week. So it looks like he'll have to sit in his cell until next year. Poor Dom. I cannot think of another person who I have done a 180 on faster than Dominic Mysterio. This guy is fantastic. I can't wait to see what they do on Valentine's Day. So I hope whatever you may be doing today, just relax, enjoy the show. There will be no live stream tomorrow night since there is no new episode of Monday Night Raw. The new Ric Flair documentary drops tomorrow on Peacock. I may save my thoughts on that for next Sunday. Back live on YouTube Wednesday night after Dynamite, and again on Friday after what is shaping up to be a very big episode of SmackDown with the return of John Cena teaming up with Kevin Owens against Roman Reigns and Sami Zayn. I am expecting a Kevin Owens win to set up a championship match with Roman Reigns at the Royal Rumble, and maybe we'll get a sense of the WrestleMania direction for John Cena, since it sounds like he is in for a match next year They're going to try to work around his shooting schedule. Next Saturday, the plan is I will be back live on YouTube for the third straight year for my New Year's Eve stream. No idea what we'll be talking about, but it's always fun to ring in the new year with you guys. So lots of content coming. But first, I can make the announcement now that after a year since the last installment, RSPW Rewind is back. And it is back tonight as my Christmas present to all of our channel members on YouTube. We have a lot of new channel members, around 150 new ones in just the last few weeks. Many of you were gifted memberships by other fans of the show, which I believe are only good for 30 days. Some of you bought a membership yourself. I thank you for that. And one of the perks of channel membership is early access to special features, just like RSPW Rewind. So you guys get it first, probably for the first 24 hours. So watch for that tonight. If you are listening to this here on Christmas Day, it'll be up for everybody else by Monday night. And this episode, I will tell you, is focused entirely on Bill Goldberg, since this year marks 25 years since his debut on WCW Monday Nitro. I dug up a bunch of posts about Goldberg from back then, starting in 97, and then going through many years and what people were saying about him, and it is a very illuminating episode. I'll leave it at that. I am sure Bret Hart will be watching. I want to thank our PayPal producers for this week. You guys have been supporting the show all throughout the year, and especially here during the holiday season. I thank you for that. It means a lot to me. You can always drop a PayPal dono if you want on thesolidmonster.com. The PayPal link is right there at the top of the link tree. The only thing better than a Christmas tree is my link tree, and you'll see it right there at the top. I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, who is ringing in the Christmas holiday, not in snow and ice and frigid temperatures. He's off in Hawaii. I'm very jealous. But Paul, thank you very much for your very generous support. I appreciate that. Night Stalker, Nayef Al-Safar, Big B, Brian Becerra, James Hollywood Herrera, Feliz Navidad to you as well. Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Killshot, Keith Hart, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Billy Hardcore, Habibi, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, John Raging Mad Riffle. It can't be too mad, it's Christmas. What's there to be mad about? Shin Superkick, Akuma, Sherrod, Big Daddy Boyd, Merry Christmas to you, and Jessica to you as well. The Seattle Saint, Marco Wallace, said the last time I donated was the week I turned 19, and you gave me a birthday shout-out. This week I turned 25, and I figured it's been a while, so here you go. Thank you for being the best wrestling podcast and going strong every single week. Happy birthday, Marco, and thank you for that. It is much appreciated. King Keeks, Enrique Hernandez, who has gotten into a debate with some friends over who is the least, quote-unquote least, successful of the three members of the Shield. And he says that, I, like you, agree that Seth Rollins is the third most successful member. I wanted to know why this is, to help end this debate. Well, just tell him I said so. That's all the explanation you need. Tell them that the Solid Monster said so, and that should be the end of the debate. Check out the Resilience brand. Go to resiliencebrandla.bigcartel.com. They've got some cool shit there, including wrestling pins and other merch. And by the way, fix your Instagram page. Get that Instagram page up and running. I go to it and it's broken, but check out Resilience Brand. They got some cool stuff there. And check out the Lightning Link Lounge. If you like playing games online, you want to try to win some money, the Lightning Link Lounge is the place to be. You can play slots as well as Keno and poker games like Texas Hold'em, Blackjack, and Roulette. Thousands of games to choose from, and they pay winners on a daily basis. For more information, search for Lightning Link Lounge on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and TikTok. You must be 18 years or older to play. Ages may vary outside the U.S. An ID is required. Text 727-910-8809 to get started. I got some brief WWE updates to run through. Starting with Mandy Rose, per TMZ Sports. Mandy Rose, no longer getting a WWE check, but she is raking in the dough. because according to TMZ, the former NXT Women's Champion has made $500,000 off of her content on her personal page in just 1 week. The story says that she was fired last Wednesday after posting racy pics on the subscription-based platform FanTime, which is similar to OnlyFans, something that is a big no-no for the WWE brand. While the firing was controversial in the eyes of many, it has also done wonders for Rose's business on the platform, with her agent, First Round Management's Malki Kawa, telling us the 32-year-old has earned a whopping $500,000 from her FanTime page since she got the axe. In fact, Kawa predicts, and this is crazy, that Rose will be a self-made millionaire by Christmas. That's today. So Mandy Rose is a new millionaire. And First Round Management, they manage a whole bunch of different wrestlers. Mandy, Johnny Gargano, Indy Hartwell. I know there's a few others. So, I mean, look, when all of this went down, and we talked about this on the podcast last week, we did a whole story and segment on Mandy Rose. And I gave you my thoughts on that whole situation. I find it very hard to believe that WWE did not have a conversation with her about this previously, and that this she was totally blindsided. I had no idea that this could happen or that this was coming. But after everything happened and she got shit-canned, she increased her monthly subscription fee on her page from $20 to $30 a month. And it sure as hell sounds like she's raking in the dough. So good for her. She can roll around naked in it and charge $500 in tips. This woman never has to take another bump a day in her life. There was more Matt Riddle drama on social media, and I did not even want to cover this, honestly, and I'm not getting into all the nuts and bolts and all the different women now that have come out and accused him of cheating and this and that. I don't give a shit about any of that. But because I did cover the Matt Riddle stuff last week, and the rumor and the belief is that he is currently in rehab on what may have been his second violation of the WWE wellness policy, although nothing has been confirmed on that front, there was some social media drama involving Matt Riddle this week. Based on a message from a woman that he, I guess, was dating, she claimed that he was in rehab. And her name is Jordan Max. Now, I believe she's a porn star. This is a different porn star than the one that he was linked to recently, Misha Montana. I'm trying to get my porn star straight here. Apparently, he was with her previously. Anyway, Jordan Max wrote this. Try to imagine for 1 second the man that you have spent the last 6 months with who said, I love you for the first time 2 months ago, is all of a sudden making out with someone else who is in your industry. And then, rather than keeping plans for Christmas and New Year's Eve, he's going to rehab. Do you have any idea how confusing and hurtful that is? And when confronted by someone on Twitter, she said, he told me that he quit drugs, and then to find out that he's A, with another girl, B, doing those drugs with her, and C, failing drug tests so he has to go to rehab for it, is disappointing. Now, I'm not saying that just because she went on Twitter that makes it official, but, again, where there's smoke, well, I mean, where Matt Riddle is, you would expect there to be smoke, but where there's smoke, there's fire to the whole rehab story. Now, Riddle went on Twitter and said this. He said, I've been working a lot on myself lately and have been saying no and setting boundaries for the first time ever, and certain people aren't happy about it, but I could not be healthier or happier. Thank you for all the support. There's another woman, Daniela Pietro, apparently someone he was with earlier this year. She made allegations against him, wanted him fired from WWE. There have been a lot of allegations levied against Matt Riddle, not just about, you know, cheating and stuff, but abuse. There's always something, it seems like, involving this guy. Now, WWE has still not said a word about any of this. It has not answered questions about its drug policy because a second suspension in the wellness program is supposed to be an automatic 60-day suspension. And if you remember the cover story for the injury angle they did with him and Solo Sikoa a few weeks ago, they said that he's expected back on Monday Night Raw in about 6 weeks. And also, they have not announced anything publicly as far as him failing any tests. That would be a change from how they have done things in the past when it comes to their policy. Now, if the rehab story is accurate, and there was a report in the Observer last week, there's a lot of talent in the company that believe that to be, you know, the actual situation here. then it looks like WWE is either ignoring their own policy or they very quietly made changes to it without telling anybody. But I hear all of this stuff, and it's hard to keep track of all the different people coming forward on social media, and he's dating this porn star, he's dating that porn star. How long before Riddle becomes a liability that Triple H and Nick Khan and Stephanie McMahon can't ignore? How long before he becomes too big of a distraction for Triple H to salvage? There's always some sort of personal drama that seems to spill over onto social media. I mean, this is not a company that likes drama. Bronson Reed is back in WWE. This has been rumored for a while now that he was on Triple H's list of talent that he wanted to bring back to the company who were released over the past year. This is also Jonah from Impact Wrestling and from New Japan Pro Wrestling, for those who are unaware. He popped up during a winner-take-all ladder match on Raw Monday night between Dexter Lumis and The Miz with two giant bags of money hanging from above the ring. And it's kind of a metaphor, I guess, because it looks like he chose the money over what would have been, I'm sure, a big monster push in New Japan. So it's kind of appropriate that he showed up here. But he interfered in the match. He yanked Lumis off the ladder and ended up giving him a big tsunami splash off the ropes. Miz ends up winning the match. So from beating Okada in the G1 climax to being The Miz's heavy, this is now the career trajectory for Bronson Reed. And I said this on the stream on Monday, Tommaso Ciampa getting hurt clearly threw a wrench into their creative plans. Not just, I think, for whatever they were going to do with him and The Miz, but for Johnny Gargano as well, because I am convinced at this point that the ultimate goal would have been to get Gargano and Ciampa together in some way, whether they were going to feud, whether they were going to go with the idea that I propose, which is to get them back together as a tag team, because I think it would be a shame to not have a great DIY run on the main roster before they kind of go their separate ways and get singles runs. I mean, they were so fucking great together in NXT. But then Ciampa got hurt, and he's going to be out for a while yet. I think it kind of blew up their plans. So now he's been replaced by Bronson Reed. Miz is the go-to guy here, whether it was John Morrison, Alex Riley, Damian Sandow, Ciampa, now Reed. There's always somebody being put with The Miz when Maurice isn't around. And you look at a lot of these names and how things turned out for them, it's not a great track record. Alex Riley didn't work out. Sandow got over doing the Mizdow stuff, but they cut that off. Ciampa got hurt. But, you know, the pairing with Miz was a weird one to begin with because it didn't fit with Ciampa's character. I mean, it was a complete mismatch. So I hope that Bronson Reed finds more success than they did. He has one thing that none of those guys have, which is size. None of those guys have the size of a... Not too many people in that company have the size of a Bronson Reed. So that might work to his advantage. But this does not have to be a long-term arrangement. I don't hate the arrangement. Is it what I would have done? No. My first inclination when I see somebody like Bronson Reed is not to go, oh, I know, I'll put him together with the fucking Miz. No. But this does not have to be a long-term arrangement. It's just a way to establish him as an ass-kicker. Hopefully that's what they have in mind for him. They can move away from it anytime they want to next year. There were a lot of people saying, oh my God, he got no reaction when he showed up. You know, he showed up, nobody knew who he was, everybody was silent. And again, I don't understand what people were expecting here, because this is not somebody, unlike a Tegan Nox and some of these other people from NXT who did have a brief main roster run. He never debuted on Raw or SmackDown. He had some dark matches. He thought he was going to be called up. Triple H thought he was going to be called up. Triple H pushed for him to be called up. He thought he was ready to be called up. Vince McMahon had other ideas. He took one look at him and said, I'm not impressed. And then he got fired. So he never worked a match on Raw or SmackDown. So I don't know why people think that on a random episode of Raw in front of wherever the hell they were on Monday, why people would look at him and go, oh my God, it's Bronson Reed from NXT. Or holy shit, it's Jonah from Impact Wrestling. Give me a fucking break. Give the man a chance to get over before you start shitting all over him. There's a lot of people who have been called up who are not getting reactions right now. You look at SmackDown, you look at Hit Row. I mean, Emma, I mean, there's so many people. But this guy has a clean slate now on the main roster. Let's give him a chance to actually get over before we start writing him off. I just think that's ridiculous. He's an athletic, super heavyweight who never got a fair shot. He had a very brief run on NXT, even as the North American champion, once they belted him, because again, they thought he was getting called up to the main roster. He said so himself. That's why they took the title off of him. It was a shock to everybody when he wasn't. And his release was just baffling. So we can poke fun at Triple H for turning into Tony Khan. Oh, Triple Khan, right? He's going on a signing frenzy and bringing all these people in. This is Triple H righting a wrong that was done. He felt he had to, you know, bring this guy back to give him a shot because he thinks, obviously, that he can make money with this guy. And for Bronson Reed, you know, he had a good thing developing with New Japan. I'm sure it was not an easy decision for him to walk away from that. But in his mind, he may not have gotten another shot at this. He had unfinished business in WWE. He moved to this country. He was down there at the Performance Center for so long. He had a run on NXT. All those years and all that time invested to have it ripped away from him for no good reason. In his mind, there's got to be a part of it that says, fuck, you know, I have unfinished business here. Things did not end the way that I wanted them to end. Triple H has always been a believer in me. He's got the book. He's got the power now. It's now or never. This may be my only shot. And of course, there's also the money issue. Because in The Observer, Meltzer made it very clear there is a lot more money now to be had in WWE than there is for most people in New Japan. And in New Japan, he probably could have had himself a good position near the top and been pushed more as more of a main event level talent than he will, maybe on Monday Night Raw. But the difference in money between the two sides, he says, is enormous. So I'm sure the money played a factor in this as well. I hope that he gets a fair shake this time to either sink or swim on his own. But again, if you've never seen him before, he's a big guy, but he's, you know, athletic, he's agile, he can do things, he can move around in the ring. Promo-wise, there's nothing about his promos that are blow away, but, you know, he could talk if you put a mic in front of him. Maybe this is the way to go initially, to ease him in. He doesn't have to do a lot of talking if he's going to be with The Miz. All he has to do is stand there and grunt and look mean and beat people up. You do that for a while. How many guys over the years have we seen get over doing that, right? They don't go out there and talk. They go out there and they kick ass. That's the easiest way to get over. And Teddy Long, speaking to Sports Kita Wrestling, chimed in on the report from last week, the Wall Street Journal story, that Vince McMahon may be looking to make a comeback at WWE. And this is what Teddy Long had to say about that. I don't see whether there was any reason for him to step down or go away. That's just my opinion, because I don't know the circumstances or all the facts about what's been going on. But I just didn't see a reason for him to step away. And if he wants to come back, let him come back. That's one hell of a statement right there. I don't know the circumstances or the facts around what's been going on. Basically, I have no idea what I'm talking about, but I don't think there was any reason for him to leave, and if he wants to, then he should come back. The L in Teddy Long stands for loyalty. Sounds like a very loyal man. It also stands for lousy take. And I am reminded of a tweet that went up this week that was just perfect. Big Damo, or Killian Dane, for those of you who don't know him as Big Damo, tweeted this, actually, about Lacey Evans this week, but I think it applies here too. He said, "Some wrestlers are just fucking stupid. I don't know what to tell you." That is an evergreen tweet. I think I'm going to be using that a lot in the new year. Now let's get into the top story this week. We joke about it every week. It's been a recurring theme this year. Where is Miro? Christmas is his birthday, by the way. He turns 37 years old today. Why has he been missing from AEW television? Why does he appear so inconsistently? Is he hurt? Is he filming a television show? He was filming a television show for a few weeks early in the year. He hasn't been filming anything since then. I mean, maybe with his wife, but that's their business, and it wouldn't have anything to do with why he's not on TV. Has he been hurt? Yes, he was. He was hurt late last year. But he has been healthy for a long time. So where the hell has he been? The man has wrestled a grand total of 4 matches this year. Well, we have an update. from Dave Meltzer that shed some light on what has been going on with our old Bulgarian friend. He claims, according to this report, that in September, Tony Khan came to Miro with an idea that would build to a match for him at the Full Gear pay-per-view in November. And Miro did not want to do it. Whatever this idea was, allegedly he rejected the idea. I cannot confirm that the name of Meltzer's source rhymes with Coney Tan, but it sure sounds like it. So that's the claim from the AEW side. And my first thought was that he offered Miro a spot in the World Title Eliminator Tournament and probably a match with Ricky Starks in the finals at Full Gear. He probably would have gotten the spot that ultimately went to Ethan Page. Now that's just me speculating on what it could have been. As it turned out, the finals of that Eliminator got bumped off the Full Gear card to the Dynamite show the following Wednesday, which I think was Thanksgiving Eve. I really don't see what other match it could have been unless they put him in the TNT title match instead of Powerhouse Hobbs. So I'm glad things worked out the way they did because Hobbs got a pay-per-view match, and I'm glad they did something with Ethan Page, who they should be doing more with. I could also understand Miro being sour on the idea, since they did the exact same thing with him last year. He went to the finals of the Eliminator Tournament. He lost to Bryan Danielson in a spot that was probably earmarked, not for him, but for Jon Moxley, had he not checked himself into rehab first. I think it would have been Moxley and Danielson with a Moxley heel turn. We'll never know. But maybe he looked at this and just thought that it was a waste to be right back in the same spot that he was in the year before, if I'm right and that's the idea. He may have looked at that and said, that's the same fucking thing that I was doing a year ago, and I go to the finals and I lose, and what good does that do me? Now, he was on the Forbidden Door card in June, and he lost in the All-Atlantic title four-way. He was on the All-Out card on the winning team with Sting and Darby Allin against the House of Black. Outside of that, he has done nothing. And I see both sides of the argument here. On the one hand, why would Miro want to come back to be used in the same role that he was in before to put somebody else over if there was no other plan for him? And on the other hand, Miro is not Bret Hart with creative control for the last 30 days of his contract. If Tony Khan pitches an idea for you that's going to get you back on TV, which is where he should be, where does this guy get off thinking that he can just say, nah, I don't think so, and then continue to drop cryptic comments about AEW not using him? That makes it sound like he's just been completely forgotten about, and they've had no ideas for him. Whenever, you know, Miro was on the red carpet with his wife being interviewed, this was a couple of weeks ago, and they asked him, hey, what's the deal with you and AEW? When are we going to see you back on TV? And he made some comment to the effect of, well, it's not my call, you know, the ball's in their court. I mean, you hear stuff like this and you would think that he has legitimately just been forgotten about, that Tony Khan forgot that he even has this guy under contract. It sounds like that may not be the case. As is usually the case, the truth may lie somewhere in the middle. But I see it both ways. But to look at this, I tend to lean on the side of Tony Khan is paying you what I'm sure is very good money to not sit on your ass at home and play games on Twitch all day. If he has proposed a creative idea to use you on TV to get you a match on pay-per-view, then get your ass back to work and get in the ring. But again, we don't have the full story directly from Miro or from AEW. We're going by one news report and some cryptic comments. Now, we also have Rusev's wife, or Miro's wife, I still call him Rusev. Miro's wife, CJ Perry, the former Lana, doing a radio interview on the Mike Wenmacher show. I have no idea who Mike Wenmacher is, but Mike Wenmacher has a show. And CJ was on his show this past Tuesday to promote the Surreal Life reboot that she is in on VH1. I didn't even know there was a Surreal Life reboot. Apparently Dennis Rodman is in it. Frankie Muniz is in it from Malcolm in the Middle. Stormy Daniels. Oh, this is quite the cast of characters they've assembled here. She went on the show, and she said that Rusev Day will never die. It's always going to be around. The kids are going to want to sing it, and I'm sure it will make a return in WWE at some point. Rusev, well, whatever he shows up as, whatever frickin' name or gimmick or character he returns as at some point, in WWE is going to be iconic. Let's be honest, we know that everyone always returns back to WWE at some point. What a stupid fucking thing to say. If your husband is trying to get booked on television, not by WWE, but by the company he's actually currently employed by. Especially if this report is true that Tony Khan did pitch an idea to bring him back and he turned it down, for his wife to go out there and flat out say, he'll be back in WWE one day and it'll be this glorious thing. If I'm Tony Khan, why the hell would I want to invest in this guy after that? Why would I want to build anything around him? Look at the size of the AEW roster. They barely have time for all the other people they have. I sure as hell would think twice before I use this guy in any kind of major angle now. I mean, you have MJF going on TV and talking about the bidding war of 2024 and jolly old St. Nick Khan, but that's his gimmick. And even you could say there, you know what, tone it down a little bit, maybe not talk about WWE so much, but that's been part of his gimmick now for over a year. If you don't like the creative that they are pitching for you, you don't get to turn around then and play victim that you're being wasted by sitting on the sidelines. You could say no if you want. You could object, but you can't then turn around and say, oh, they don't use me. I don't know why they won't use me. I'm healthy. I'm ready. But they won't use me. I don't know, guys. You should talk to them. Maybe Lana just wants to go back to WWE with him so they can have sex in the tank again, like they did at WrestleMania. I don't know. Miro tweeted Meltzer after the Observer report came out. He tweeted Meltzer on Thursday, and he asked, what happened between January and June? And he did not deny the report that Tony Khan presented him with an idea coming out of All Out in September. So I read that as, what about the first half of the year when Tony Khan wasn't using me? And that's a valid point. But let's jump back in time here and see what was happening in the first half of this year. Back in March, Fightful reported that AEW re-signed Miro to a 4-year contract extension that would keep him with the company through at least the beginning of 2026. They said that the deal was agreed upon late last year, but took a while before it was finally signed, but it was signed and it was a done deal. Now, at that point, he had not wrestled since Full Gear last year against Danielson. He was dealing with a hamstring injury, but Fightful was told at the time, now this is March, Fightful was told at the time that he's been good to go for a while now. Around that same time, though, is when he posted photos on social media from his apartment in New York that he was living in for a few weeks while he shot scenes for that East New York pilot for CBS. So we know that around that period of time, he was filming something, at least for a few weeks in New York City. So then in June, he gave an interview to Fightful where he talked about re-signing with the company. He said, they wanted me to sign a long-term deal for a reason, and I signed long-term for a reason. And he laughed when he said this. He said, it's a place where I can be creatively free, and now the ball is in my court. My boss, Tony Khan, let me have that and said, hey, go do you. I feel that played a big role in my decision to be here. Everybody watching AEW knows that I am a world champion. I know it. I would be shortchanging myself and TK to say that I'm not. I walk around with that mentality as well. I don't want to sit around and collect a check. I want to create and evolve and become world champion. Before that, I'm focusing on the All Atlantic Championship, which is going to be even bigger than the world championship. Well, it's nice to have goals. But again, he was talking about this in promoting Forbidden Door. He said, I love this place. Tony Khan believes in me. He lets me do me and doesn't have to be involved in every single thing. I love that. I love working with him. I love this company. I love the stacked roster. Like 99% of these people I'm fighting now is for the first time. I love those challenges. I love every single time I step foot in the ring. Sometimes I have 30 to 45 seconds, but I make the most of it every single time. That's what it's all about. It's not just about having great matches or having 20 to 30 minute matches that are great. We only have so much television. It's about what you do with the 30 to 45 seconds that you have. This is where I excel the most. I gave Tony Khan a discount. That's on that first contract. I gave him a discount and said, Tony, I will sign for this money because it's the pandemic. But after that year and a half, we're coming strong. I knew that he was signing the wrong guy. He was signing the Twitch guy. He's basing his opinions on my Twitch. And that's where the whole thing with Kip Sabian started. I knew that wasn't me. That's just not who I am. I knew once the year and a half was over, I was going to show him who I am and what I'm capable of. And we're going to sit down and talk like men for men's money. That's exactly what happened. In that same interview, he said, I feel great now. I got my hamstring a little tweaked. Then I got the call and had a fly to do the Orange Cassidy match. I had this great opportunity for the world title. I took care of Orange Cassidy in a hurry, but I ripped my hamstring even more. Then knowing I have to come back a week later to fight Bryan Danielson was maybe my biggest challenge so far in my career. Thankfully for Dr. Bo Hightower in New Mexico, he got me up on my feet. I was barely walking and had a week to prepare for that match. I was with him every day, a few hours a day, just so I can rehab that hamstring to be able to walk. And eventually a week later, he said, I mean, it was okay. We had the Bryan match. After that match, though, my hamstring was done. It was just screaming, I want to rest. That's what happened. I needed some time off. I thought I was going to come back around January. That's why we did those vignettes. Unfortunately, when you fall out of the wheel of AEW, our roster is so stacked with great guys, great competitors, that I can't be offended by it. Then I had a few acting gigs in the meantime that I got taken care of, so I had my time off. I loved my time doing that, but now I'm back, and I want more than I had before. So this was all said in June. So to answer the question that Miro posed to Dave, since Dave never did answer him, he filmed some vignettes thinking that he was going to be back. And by then, his hamstring should have been healed, but Tony didn't have a spot for him. So he went and he filmed some stuff. And he was happy enough to sign a long-term contract extension with them in March. And by June, he said that he was done with all the extracurricular stuff and he was ready to come back. And that's when Tony put him in the All-Atlantic title match at Forbidden Door. So there was absolutely a period of time earlier this year where Tony Khan could have been using him and he wasn't. But again, we don't know if there were ideas laid out for him that he rejected or not. Who's to say that he wasn't pitched something back in April and said, no, I don't think so. I don't want to do that. He should have been on TV, but he wasn't. But he was happy enough to sign for 4 more years. And yet, his wife is going around doing interviews, talking openly about him going back to WWE one day. Oh, how great it'll be. It sounds to me like they're frustrated, and she thinks maybe that going out and saying that might light a fire under Tony Khan to get him to put her husband back on TV. But if I'm Tony Khan, and I'm hearing stuff like that, again, why would he want to focus on Miro when he has got at least a dozen other people who want to be there, who could take his spot? You know, in June, Miro said he loves AEW. He loves the freedom that Tony Khan gives him. But now his wife is talking about how everybody always ends up back in WWE. What the fuck? There's a disconnect here somewhere. If it's a matter of Miro not wanting to do jobs, I mean, unless he has creative control written into his contract, and Tony Khan would be an idiot for agreeing to that, then that's just something he's going to have to deal with. He's going to have to accept. I mean, I like Miro, and it's good to be confident in your ability, but he's not fucking Brock Lesnar. If he's uncomfortable with what's being proposed for him, get on the phone with Tony Khan, or get in a room together and hash it out. I mean, I don't understand this. A whole year has gone by now. What is going on here? You signed a new contract. You were happy enough to sign a new long-term contract. You're healthy. You said you don't want to just sit around and collect a paycheck. Sounds to me like the ball's in his court, just like he said in that interview. But if you sign a 4-year extension for more money to stay with one company, it is disrespectful to go out there either directly or through your wife and openly talk about how iconic it's going to be when you go back to the other company. If it were me, I wouldn't want to waste my time on that person either. You know, maybe Miro just needs to talk to somebody. He's not going to talk to Tony Khan. Maybe he can find a therapist to talk to. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. You know, the holidays are here, and for a lot of people, it's a happy time. It's a time to be with family and friends. But for others, maybe some of you listening, it can be a very difficult time of year, or maybe worse than usual if you're dealing with depression, feelings of isolation. The holiday season can make that even worse. And that's where BetterHelp can be a great resource. They've connected over 3 million people with licensed therapists who can help guide you through these emotions and make this time of year a little bit more tolerable. BetterHelp is convenient, secure, and accessible anywhere 100% online. Sometimes it just helps to talk to someone, to know that they're there and that they know what you're going through, they know what they're talking about, whether it's learning the coping skills to deal with a certain trauma in your life, or in my case, it wasn't anything nearly as serious as that, but I connected with a therapist through BetterHelp to help with some issues I had sleeping. Whatever it may be, the benefits of therapy are clear. Everyone deserves to feel their best. BetterHelp makes it easy to get started. As the world's largest therapy service, they've matched millions of people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists. It has the benefits of in-person therapy, but it's more convenient, more accessible, and more affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If you try it and you don't think things are working out, it's very easy to switch to a different therapist that you do feel comfortable with. So this holiday season, if you're feeling stuck, get unstuck with BetterHelp. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/solomonster. That's betterhelp.com/solomonster. I watched NXT on Tuesday, had some thoughts. I thought it was a great opener with Carmelo Hayes beating Axiom and then a very good exchange on the mic later on when Hayes came back out to interrupt Apollo Crews, which sets up the next program for both men. I still think Bron Breakker beats Grayson Waller in New Year's Evil and he defends the NXT championship against Carmelo Hayes, either at Vengeance Day in February or maybe Stand and Deliver. The winner of the match between Hayes and Crews should be to set up the number one contender since Hayes, you know, he came out here, he felt like Apollo was cutting the line in front of him, so it would make sense for this to be a number one contenders match. But the thing with the vignettes that Apollo did with Breakker at the diner and on the boat, and this segment here, is his dialogue has felt more natural. A lot more natural than dialogue you would hear on the main roster. So this was really good. I thought the triple threat for the women's tag team titles was good. Katana Chance and Kayden Carter retaining when Carter pushed off the ropes with her feet to reverse out of Ivy Nile's submission finish and pinned her, the Bret Hart finish. That would not be the only Bret Hart spot on this show. Carter and Chance, they have really grown into a good tag team, but I'm not feeling this pairing with Ivy Nile and Tatum Paxley. I liked it better when they had Ivy as the solo badass. This just feels like they needed to pad the division with some teams, and so they paired the two of them up. Paxley doesn't really fit into the whole Diamond Mine thing. The Booker T interview. I wanted to mention this. Booker T did a sit-down interview with the brand new NXT Women's Champion, someone he knows very well, Roxanne Perez. This was the best part of the entire episode. I want to see this side of Booker more often, instead of him hamming it up for TV all the time. This was refreshing. He played this very low-key and serious. Roxanne is his former student from Reality of Wrestling. He helped train her, so he's been playing the role of Proud Papa on TV now for a while. They showed highlights of her winning the title from Mandy Rose, photos from early in her career, which, of course, early in her career wasn't that long ago because she's only 21 years old. But I thought this whole presentation was very well done. Booker, I thought, was great here. They're having a battle for the bar on next week's show. Now, what is a battle for the bar? Are we reuniting Sheamus and Cesaro? No. No. Are they fighting over the right to take the bar exam? No. No, they're fighting for an actual bar. Fallon Henley and Kiana James next week are going to go, well, actually this Tuesday, are going to go one-on-one to find out who is going to be able to own the bar that is owned by her family. So basically what has happened here is Kiana James has cozied up to Jensen, of Brooks and Jensen, who are managed by Fallon Henley. Fallon and her parents, Kiana has learned, have fallen on tough times financially with their bar. And so she took it upon herself, because her gimmick is that she's some sort of financial guru. She took it upon herself to pay off their outstanding tax bill. So now she can buy the bar outright from the bank and then do what she wants with it. Maybe a lawyer can chime in on this, because this doesn't sound right to me. But maybe Shawn Michaels consulted with Joseph Park Esquire before they wrote this segment. I don't know. I hear his brother works for WWE now. It wouldn't be very hard. But Fallon called her a real bitch. Kiana said that she prefers businesswoman or business person. Fallon challenged her to a match where if she wins, her parents get out of debt, she takes the lien off the bar, and Kiana leaves them alone forever. But if Kiana wins, because she says that would be ridiculous, why would I agree to this? If Kiana wins, then Fallon's parents will sign the bar over to Kiana for only what she paid for it. So basically, pennies on the dollar. I like this world that they have created where you can settle real estate disputes, not in a court of law, but in the ring at the performance center. I find this fascinating. So Fallon Henley was out later on in the show to manage Briggs and Jensen for their NXT tag team title match. They had a shot at the New Day. This was the match of the night, which isn't saying much, but it was a good match. Josh Briggs busted out a picture-perfect top rope moonsault that I was not expecting him to be able to do. That was maybe the surprise of the night. But they had no chance to win this. New Day retains. They're not dropping those titles at least until Vengeance Day. They've got tickets to sell. That's why they put the belts on the New Day to begin with. They're going back out on the road, right? Big pay-per-view coming up in Charlotte. February 4th, I believe it is. They've got tickets to sell. The latest update from WrestleTix has them just shy of 3,000 tickets sold already for a setup of about 4,500. Once they start announcing matches, New Day should help them move a few tickets. Not like John Cena on SmackDown this Friday, but they should do okay. It looks like they're going to sell out in Tampa on Friday. John Cena will have helped this company move more than 5,000 tickets for that show since they announced him for SmackDown. You want to know who the real needle mover is in this company? It ain't Roman Reigns. It's still John Cena. And they had a show-long storyline with Grayson Waller, not wanting to wait until New Year's Evil to get his hands on Bron Breakker. He was calling him out all night. He was going around. He was interrupting different backstage segments. Hey, Bron, where are you, Bron? Well, Bron wasn't there. Finally, at the end of the show, though, the champion decided to show up. Waller was in the ring calling him out. Bron pulls up to the building. He marches down to the ring. He hits Waller with a spear, but he knocks himself out in the process. And Waller takes off his jacket to reveal a Kevlar vest. And hidden in the vest was what I guess was supposed to be a metal plate, but it looked, legitimately, it looked like either cardboard or styrofoam. I think it was cardboard. And he posed with the NXT title to end the show. I love the idea of Shawn Michaels paying tribute to Bret Hart's best moment in WCW. Of all the things that Bret did in WCW, hiding a steel plate under his Maple Leafs jersey so Goldberg would knock himself silly when he speared him, that was the most badass. The old fistful of dollars scene with Clint Eastwood. Only Grayson Waller is not nearly as cool as Clint Eastwood was in that movie, or as cool as Bret Hart, and he never will be. But I appreciate the callback. It was over 20 years ago. What was that, 1999 that they did that? How many newer fans would even know that that's been done before? They probably, why, half the people who watch this show probably watch this and go, oh my God, that was so creative. I've never seen that before. We got a whole new generation of people who don't know any better. Doesn't matter though. He's still not winning the title. With all that out of the way, now it is time. Each year, I rank my favorite matches of the year, and I have been sticking to a top 15 format the past few years because there's so many great matches. 10 is too few, but I feel like 20 would be cheating to include that many. So 15 feels like a good compromise to me. And then I rank them right down to what I feel was the best match that I saw all year. And I saw a lot of great ones this year. From WWE, AEW, New Japan, even Impact. Shout out to Luke, who hooked me up with a list of great matches from Impact this year, some of which I had already seen, many of which I had not. last year on my list, the top spot went to the Young Bucks and the Lucha Brothers for their incredible cage match that they had it all out. It was the first time I had a tag team match in the number one spot in 5 years. So will history repeat itself again? Let's find out. This is my list. And that's the key words there, my list. My list is probably going to look different than your list. This is my list of the 15 best matches of 2022, ranked from number 15, we'll start from the bottom, all the way up to what I thought was the best match of the year. Now, I want to start with some honorable mentions. None of those Impact matches that I watched made my list. But the hour-long match between Josh Alexander and Speedball Mike Bailey from the December 8th episode of Impact was very good. Alexander has a storyline going right now with Bully Ray. He had an open challenge. He wanted Bully to accept, but he didn't. Mike Bailey took the match instead. And they went out there, completely unexpected, for an hour, and they went to war. And it's been great hearing about all these great matches that Mike Bailey has been having. And I've seen some of them, but probably not as many as I should. But after being banned from the U.S. for 5 years, right? I think the whole thing was he tried to get into the country. There was a work visa issue. They banned him. He couldn't work in the U.S. for 5 years. And he was a huge, you know, name that was on the rise back then. And so now he's back and he is just going balls to the wall with all these great matches. But it's crazy to me that on cagematch.net, this match ranked as the second best match in Impact history, behind only the Unbreakable Three-Way from 2005 with AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, and Christopher Daniels. I don't know if I'd go that far. It was very good, but I was also bored during parts of it, and that crowd absolutely sucked. I know there weren't that many people in the building to begin with, but it sounded like an empty arena match watching this. So that did not help. The match between Jon Moxley and Wheeler Yuta from the April 8th episode of AEW Rampage also gets a mention. Maybe the best match in Rampage history. Certainly one of the best matches in Rampage history. I remember hearing great things about it from the taping that week. Then I watched it when it aired, and it exceeded my expectations. I love the story they told. Yuta had already been beaten by Moxley twice before, but he wanted his respect. Yuta, I mean, he bled buckets. He kept kicking out of everything Moxley threw at him. He lost again in the end, but Bryan Danielson and William Regal, they came to the ring after. Regal shook his hand, and he was officially christened as, you know, the newest member of the Blackpool Combat Club. I thought that night when it was over that this was the night that Yuta went from some guy to a guy on that roster. And he has not had a breakout match like that since. He's had some very good ones with Daniel Garcia, but he's not had a breakout match like that since. But it was still one of my favorite AEW matches all year. The IWGP women's title match from the New Japan Stardom crossover show last month between Kairi and Mayu Iwatani, that was also very good. Not top 15 worthy for me, but it deserves an honorable mention. As does the AEW Women's Championship match from Wednesday's Holiday Bash episode of Dynamite between Jamie Hayter and Hikaru Shida. They gave those women the main event spot, and they killed it. And I struggled with this. I tried very hard to squeeze this match into my top 15 because I had fun watching it. It was that great. I don't know if it's the recency bias or what, but I thought that was one of the best AEW matches all year. And one of the best women's matches in the history of that company. But I just could not find a spot for it. I could not bump off any of my other 15 matches, so it just fell a little bit short. So let's begin with number 15. Becky Lynch against Bianca Belair for the Raw Women's Championship at WrestleMania 38. It was this or the Hayter match in this spot. And this one just edged it out for me. You know, the best match is bell to bell. At this year's WrestleMania, both came on night one, on Saturday, and it's the flip of a coin, which was the better of the two. I went with this one over Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins. This was the culmination of the story that started with Becky taking the title from Bianca at SummerSlam last year in 26 seconds. Back then, it was the SmackDown women's title, before Becky and Charlotte had their ill-fated belt swap. By the time this was over, Bianca's eye, I mean, she was looking like Sloth from the Goonies. She got kicked in the eye by Becky. But they had a great match with a great finish. And Bianca getting her revenge. Number 14 is a match that will be talked about for years to come. And highlights of this match will be shown when he wins the WWE Championship next year. It is Cody Rhodes with a torn pectoral muscle against Seth Rollins inside Hell in a Cell from the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view on June 5th. Hopefully the last Hell in a Cell pay-per-view they ever do. This was the third match in their trilogy this year after Cody left AEW. He returned to WWE in what would have been the most shocking story of the year. Or second most, I guess, after the Brawl Out stuff. Any other year, it would have been the number one or two story of the year. Any other year but this one. But all three matches were very good, but this is the one that people are going to remember the most. I will never forget the hush that fell over that crowd when Cody took his jacket off and he revealed all the bruising on his chest and under his arm. I mean, it went around to the back of his arm. And that was all blood that was pooling under the skin. This was uncomfortable to watch, as was watching Rollins jamming a kendo stick repeatedly into Cody's pec. They allowed him to work the match because he couldn't make the injury any worse, but that doesn't mean it felt too good to be out there wrestling with it. He also realized, I think, what happened here. Cody had to realize that this was his big moment. He did not want to let down Vince McMahon for trusting him in a main event spot on pay-per-view. He was on the poster. They built the show. The entire show was built around him and Seth Rollins. And he did not want to let them down. This was the night that Cody Rhodes became a made man in WWE. I mean, yes, he set himself on fire in AEW. But this was unlike anything that we have ever seen. And with a surprising finish to boot, given that they had to know that Cody would be gone for a long time, he was going to have surgery, to put him over Seth Rollins for a third straight time, knowing that he was going to be gone for months, that was a surprise. But now when he comes back at the Royal Rumble, he's still undefeated, and he can get the big heroic return like Triple H did in 2002. You know, I could not put together a match of the year list and not include this somewhere on my list. This was as gutsy a performance as you will ever see. Stupid? Yeah, probably that too. But he gave the performance of a lifetime here. Number 13 is the dog collar match from AEW Revolution on March 6th between CM Punk and MJF, which was also the best match on that entire pay-per-view. When CM Punk first signed with AEW, the one name I could not wait to see him programmed with was MJF. I also wanted to see him back in the ring with Bryan Danielson, but sadly we never got to see it and now we never will. But the idea of the promos between Punk and MJF was like catnip for wrestling fans. And it did not disappoint. Tony Khan went to it quicker than I thought he would. Hindsight being what it is, thank God he did. This was their second match. Their first match was almost as great as this one. That was from the Groundhog Day episode of Dynamite in Chicago. I give this one the slight edge, but that one was fantastic too. We got a Pepsi plunge from Punk in that match, probably the first one he's done since his Ring of Honor run. Punk suffered his first defeat in AEW in that match. The three commercial breaks took that one down a few notches for me, but such is the nature of live TV. We didn't have that problem here though. I loved Punk coming out in his old ROH gear to Miseria Cantare. The people didn't react to that music in Orlando the way that I think they would have if they were in Chicago or New York. I don't think they fully appreciated that entrance, but I did. I thought it was great. The match was slow. It was methodical for a while, but it was violent. It was bloody. I thought they told a great story. And when things got tough for MJF, he called on his insurance policy, Wardlow, to come on down, help him out of a jam, as he has many times before, give him the Dynamite Diamond Ring. By this point, the people were just waiting for the explosion to happen. They were ready for Wardlow to break away from MJF and break out on his own. Wardlow, he kind of pretended, he couldn't find where the ring was. He's checking his pockets until Punk regained control. And then all of a sudden, Wardlow, he found the ring. And the camera shot of him staring at Punk and Punk staring back at him, and Wardlow calmly setting the ring down on the mat for Punk to use was so great. Wardlow already had a TNT title match in his back pocket. He did not need MJF anymore. He did not need to take this man's shit any longer. And it's CM Punk clobbering MJF with the Dynamite Diamond Ring, as MJF has done many times before to his opponents. Poetic justice for Punk to win the match that way. They tore each other to shreds. But the biggest reaction was for the spot with Wardlow. And it is very frustrating how much Tony Khan has cooled off Wardlow since then. It felt like he was on the cusp of breaking out in a big way. And it just hasn't happened yet. I don't even blame Wardlow for that. But they could not have told this story any better than they did here. And the idea that I floated before all of this was that MJF would win their first match, which he did. Punk would win the rematch, which he did. Punk would then go on to win the AEW World title, which he did. And then it pays off with MJF eventually winning his first world championship by beating CM Punk to complete the story arc between them. And that's exactly how it would have played out had Punk not gotten hurt again and then torpedoed the whole thing. This story never got its rightful conclusion, and that sucks. This next match is one that I never thought would make this list, because since their first match in 2015, which was great, the matches that these two have had have largely sucked and have been very disappointing, like their WrestleMania match was this year. WWE then announced one last match between them at SummerSlam. They promised us that this would be the end. It remains to be seen if they'll hold true to their word. And if it is, they went out on a high note. Number 12 is the last man standing match from SummerSlam between Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns for the undisputed WWE Universal Championship. This was the first ever last man standing match in SummerSlam history and the ninth SummerSlam main event for Brock Lesnar, more than any other man in history. This was one of the craziest matches that I have ever seen, and I could appreciate them trying something different instead of doing the same old shit that they did in all their other matches. We had Farmer Brock driving a tractor down to the ring, jumping off the thing to get things started. Brock Lesnar is scary enough. Flying Brock Lesnar, though. It's like the first time I learned that water bugs could fly. Water bugs are scary enough without knowing that they can fly. Once I saw that they could get airborne, that was all the nightmare fuel that I needed. Life would never be the same. Because we get a lot of those around here. Brock may as well have been a flying water bug. Then we got one of the greatest visuals in wrestling history, with Brock using the front end loader on the tractor to lift up the corner of the ring a good 10 feet into the air, which sent Roman Reigns rolling out of the ring to the floor outside. We had Paul Heyman taking an F5 through the announce table. Austin Theory tried to cash in his Money in the Bank briefcase. He got laid out by an F5, though. But in the end, it was all the members of the Bloodline burying Lesnar under a mountain of furniture so that he couldn't get back to his feet by the 10 count that won it for Roman Reigns and ended one of the greatest spectacles that I've ever seen. This was the best match that these two have had since WrestleMania 31. And when it was over, it was just fun. I had fun watching this. Yeah, I watch wrestling to have fun and to enjoy myself. And that's what I did watching this. Which brings me to number 11. I had a lot of fun watching this. Will Ospreay, one-on-one with Orange Cassidy for the IWGP United States Championship at the AEW New Japan Forbidden Door Show. For all the great talent on that card, these two went out and they stole the show. There are still plenty of people who hate Orange Cassidy with a passion. They hate him with the passion of 1,000 burning suns. And they will never like him. They will never give him his just due as a worker just because of the gimmick. But he shut a lot of people up with his performance in this match. He should have shut those people up before with the match he had with Pac a couple of years ago, or the three-way with Pac and Omega back during the pandemic. But some people just can't look past the pocket stuff. And I will say, Cassidy would not have been my first choice as an opponent for Will Ospreay. If you're trying to do a dream match type scenario, AEW against New Japan, Orange Cassidy would not have been my first choice to put up against Will Ospreay. But Kenny Omega was not ready yet to come back. Pac was already booked for the All-Atlantic 4-Way. Andrade at one point claimed that he was supposed to wrestle Ospreay until politics got in the way with him doing, you know, work with AAA. All of those would have been great matches, but I had no complaints when this was over. Ospreay is a cocky prick, so him having to put up with Cassidy's, you know, shenanigans, that was fun to watch. It was a contrast in characters. Some great reversals, great near falls. The last, I'd say, 7 or 8 minutes in particular were just tremendous. But Ospreay pulls it out in the end, and then after the match is over, we had the surprise cameo from Katsuyori Shibata taking out Ospreay in Aussie Open with Orange Cassidy giving his sunglasses to Shibata to wear. I don't know that Orange Cassidy will ever have a better match than this, but Will Ospreay will, and he did. Many times, in fact, this year. We're not even into the top 10 yet. So let's get there now. The top 10 matches of the year. Number 10 was Kazuchika Okada against Shingo Takagi for the IWGP World Heavyweight title from Wrestle Kingdom 16, Night 1 at the Tokyo Dome. It would be easy to forget about this because it was the first big show of the year. And there have been so many great matches since then. But when it comes to these Wrestle Kingdom main events, one does not forget so easily. This was a rematch from the Dominion show last year where Shingo beat Okada to win the vacant title. Okada had to win the G1 to get back to the Tokyo Dome main event. And Okada was wearing Antonio Inoki-inspired gear. It was the 50th anniversary this year of the company that Inoki founded. This was before he passed away. And you had to know that for the 50th year, they would go back to their tried and true. They would go back to Okada as their guy, especially at a time with COVID just wreaking havoc on their business. A time when they needed that shot in the arm. He wins with a single Rainmaker. This was the first match of the year candidate for 2022, and it barely hangs on to the top 10, but it does make the cut on my list. Number 9 is a match I was not expecting to steal the show on a card as stacked as the one that night in Chicago, but that's exactly what these four men went out there and did. It was the Acclaimed against Keith Lee and Swerve Strickland for the AEW Tag Team Championship at All Out on September 4th. This was the night that made the Acclaimed. They didn't win the titles on this night, but this was their coming out party. This was where they kind of staked their claim that, hey, we're the real deal here. They were already over with the fans, but this crowd put their stamp of approval on them. It's like Anthony Bowen says every time they come out, the Acclaimed have arrived. They arrived at All Out. Lee and Swerve were also babyfaces coming into... I mean, Swerve was acting heelish, but they were still babyfaces at this point. Whenever they were in control, though, the crowd booed. It was made very clear very fast that the fans in Chicago wanted to see a title change. And it looked like they were going to get one. There was more than one miscommunication between Lee and Swerve during the match. They had been teasing a possible rift between them for weeks leading up to this. Each time the Acclaimed would try to capitalize and the building sounded like it was ready to explode. But then there would be a last minute kick out or a shoulder up. Max Caster, he got Keith Lee up on his shoulders for an attitude adjustment. And Keith Lee is no small man. Just ask Rick Ross. Then he hit the mic drop on Swerve, had the match won. Lee barely broke it up at the last second. In the end, Lee and Swerve hit their Doomsday Device double stomp combo. They pinned Anthony Bowens to retain the titles. And you could feel the air get sucked right out of the crowd. There was a lot of debate over that finish. Should Tony Khan have called an audible and put the titles on the Acclaimed here? I think he made the right call. As I said at the time, by holding off on it until the Grand Slam show in New York a few weeks later, they were at Arthur Ashe Stadium. This was the match that validated them. Now they could go into an even bigger building in New York City and win the titles there, which is what they did. And that was good too, but that was not as good as this match. And it could not match the excitement of this. This match was a revelation in how good it ended up being. I was not expecting that. Number 8 is going to be a polarizing choice, especially for the anti-AEW crowd, but it is some of the most fun that I have had all year watching wrestling, and it was anything but a traditional wrestling match. It was Anarchy in the Arena, with the Jericho Appreciation Society against Brian Danielson, Jon Moxley, Eddie Kingston, Santana, and Ortiz from AEW Double or Nothing on May 29th. Out of this, we got a 7-month feud between the JAS and the Blackpool Combat Club, which was at least 3 months longer than it needed to be. But this is one of the most entertaining street fights that I have ever seen in pro wrestling. It was unlike anything I had ever seen before. The first words out of the mouth of Justin Roberts when he was doing the ring introductions was, "The shit's about to hit the fan." And he was not lying. Jericho and his crew, they came to the ring, they were dressed in all white. By the end of this, they were red. There were a lot of people who were red when this thing was over. They met the baby faces in the crowd to start. They kept Moxley's music playing for the first 5 minutes of the match. It's like a bar fight scene in a movie. This was pure chaos. Tony Schiavone said that this was Memphis Tupelo stuff, which I thought was a great comparison. It made me think of the old Tupelo concession stand brawl from 1979, only crazier with a lot more people involved in a much bigger building. But I said in my review, it also reminded me of those hardcore matches the Nasty Boys had in WCW against Cactus Jack and Max Payne and against Public Enemy. Moxley loosened the top rope at one point. He took it off. And I panicked because that meant the show, it was already like 20 after 11. And I'm looking at the clock because these shows are fucking long. So he's taking the rope off and there's still two matches left. I go, oh no, it's going to make the show even longer. But while that was going on, you had Daniel Garcia and Eddie Kingston. They were off fighting inside of an elevator. In another part of the building, Santana and Ortiz, they dove off ladders through tables that had Matt Menard and Angelo Parker laid out across them. Later on, we had the sight of zombie Eddie Kingston walking. He looked like a zombie out of The Walking Dead, walking to the ring with a can of gasoline after Jericho had previously burned him with a fireball. He was going to burn them all. He poured gasoline all over Jericho and Brian Danielson. I think Danielson had him in the lapel lock, so he's getting gas on Danielson. Danielson stops him before he could light the match and says, "What the hell are you doing?" Jericho locked on a single leg crab, while Jake Hager choked out Danielson with the loose ring rope. And that gave the win to the Jericho Appreciation Society when he passed out. This was a live action version of Stadium Stampede. And it was even better than Stadium Stampede was. And as late as it was, again, I was starting to fade. This is the match that got me back into things. This woke me right up. I could not look away from what I was seeing. And in a company that goes overboard with the use of blood and weapons, they tried something different here involving all of that stuff, and it worked. And that's why I have that as number 8. Number 7 is Will Ospreay against Shingo Takagi from day 12 of this year's G1 Climax on August 6th in Osaka. Ospreay against Shingo in the finals of the Best of the Super Juniors was my match of the year. In 2019. They had that honor locked up in June that year, and they never let it go. Last year, they did it again. At Wrestling Dontaku, I had that as my number 5 match of the year. That was a match that Kevin Kelly called the best wrestling match that he has ever called. And think of the ground that that covers with all of the New Japan matches that Kevin Kelly has been on the call for. So it is no surprise that they would end up back here on this list again. These two just have a special chemistry when they get in the ring together. This year, I have them at number 7. So they're working their way down the list, but they're still in the top 10. The story coming in was that Ospreay had beaten Shingo before, but never in less than 30 minutes. And this match had a 30-minute time limit. And I think that only made the match better. It never felt overly long. It was tightened up from some of their other matches. It went about 20 minutes with Shingo picking up the win this time. I could watch these two wrestle once a year for the next 10 years and never get bored of it. I've had the chance to call a Will Ospreay match in House of Glory. I've had the opportunity to call a Shingo Takagi match, the one he had with Low Ki in House of Glory a few months ago. Maybe one of these days I'll get to call one between the two of them. Now that would be something. That would be fun. Number 6 is one of the best matches in Dynamite history, pitting Dax Harwood and Cash Wheeler against Matt and Nick Jackson. It's FTR versus the Young Bucks Part 2 From the April 6th episode of AEW Dynamite, this was winner take all for the Ring of Honor and AAA tag team titles. This was the rematch 18 months in the making. The Bucks won that first match to win their first AEW tag team titles off of FTR. Less than a week before this match, FTR beat the Briscoes to win the Ring of Honor tag team titles, and then they came in here and did this. Two match of the year candidates in the span of 5 days. As good as their first match was, this one was so much better. For one, they had more than 1,000 fans there live to see it, which is all they were allowed at Full Gear 2 years ago at Daly's Place for obvious reasons. So they didn't have a big crowd. And this time, FTR were the babyfaces, and the Bucks came in as the heels, and that dynamic worked so much better. They did a false finish spot where the Bucks got the three count, but Rick Knox missed Cash Wheeler's foot on the bottom rope, because of course, it's Rick fucking Knox. So he restarted the match. FTR set up for the Bucks' own BTE trigger to Matt Jackson, who spat in Dax's face. They pulled the trigger, and then they hit the big rig for the win. It was a clean finish right in the middle. The Bucks wanted to put them over clean since FTR did the same for them in their first match. What I also loved about this is that we did not have the usual over-reliance on super kicks or flips from the Young Bucks that we see in pretty much every single Young Bucks match. This was a toned-down version of the Young Bucks, and I think that made this match even better. But the crowd really made this feel like a big event. 4 years ago this month, the month before AEW was officially formed, Matt Jackson tweeted, "One day we'll wrestle the Revival and everyone will rejoice. Remember this tweet." I love their first match, especially the fact that if you remember their first match at Full Gear, it was a flip that ended up doing in the team that always says no flips, just fists. But this is the match that made me think of that tweet. And what it could be like with a building full of people going nuts for these two teams. That's what we got on Dynamite back in April. So now we are into the top five. My fave five, as Booker T would say. Number five is another one of the best matches in Dynamite history. And you know, say what you want to about the ratings or the lack of focus that Dynamite has had, you know, for a while this year. Last few weeks have been better. But there have been more bangers on that show this year than on Raw or SmackDown. And SmackDown has had some good ones. But some of the matches on Dynamite this year blow away anything that we've seen on Raw and SmackDown, including this one. This was Bryan Danielson against Hangman Adam Page for the AEW World Championship. This was the rematch on the very first Dynamite of the new year, the January 5th episode. This was a violent sequel to their one-hour draw on last year's Winter is Coming episode. This time, if the match were to go to a draw, it would have gone to the judges, which were Paul White, Mark Henry, and Jerry Lynn. They were all sitting at ringside, but it did not have to go to the judges. Hangman was a bloody mess. Danielson did not want to be left out, so he ended up bleeding too. Remember, he told Vince McMahon that was one of the reasons he wanted to leave WWE. He wanted to bleed. Well, he got his wish. Almost 30 minutes in, Danielson stuffed a dead-eye attempt. He hit him with a Gotch-style pile driver, covered him, only got two. Hangman hit a backdrop driver right on Danielson's head. Set up for the buckshot lariat, which connected. He turned Danielson inside out. And finally, Hangman Page hands Bryan Danielson his very first loss since coming to AEW. They somehow managed to top their last match. I like this more than I did their 60-minute match, and I love their 60-minute match. I had that as my fourth best match of 2021. Danielson did everything he could to try to take that buckshot lariat away from Hangman Page. He was working over the shoulder, but in the end, he fell victim to it. He put over one of AEW's big homegrown, I say homegrown, yes, I know, he was in Ring of Honor in New Japan, I know. But Hangman Page is not a WWE guy. He did not get to be a main eventer working somewhere else. Tony Khan turned Hangman Page, at least for a while there, into a main event talent. He cut his teeth really in AEW. And to see that type of star, a homegrown AEW star, be put over in this way by this former WrestleMania headliner, because, you know, Danielson's already a made guy. He put Paige and his finish over in the strongest possible way. And in doing so, he handed Hangman the two best matches of his career. These two and that tag team match from Revolution 2 years ago, where it was Paige and Omega against the Bucks, you will not find three better Hangman-Page matches than those. This is the kind of match I wanted out of Bryan Danielson when he signed with AEW. This was excellent. Number four takes us back to the Tokyo Dome for the second night of Wrestle Kingdom on January 5th. That was the same day as the Danielson-Hangman match I just talked about, one spot earlier. This was a great day to be a wrestling fan. Fuck Rusev Day. We had January 5th, 2022. Much as the match with Okada and Shingo the night before on January 4th, this was for the IWGP World Heavyweight title. Okada pulled out not one, but two 4.5-star matches out of his ass in the span of 24 hours. This was the better of the two main events. Okada retains with the Rainmaker, and this was Okada one-on-one with Will Ospreay. And this wasn't even the best match that these two would have this year. They would go on to have an even better match together. We may as well go straight into it. Number three on the list, which is occupied by these same two men, Okada and Ospreay, in the finals of this year's G1 Climax on August 18th. I had predicted an Okada-Ospreay final in this year's G1, with Okada winning the entire thing, and that's exactly what happened. It was the 50th anniversary for New Japan. It was Okada's 10th anniversary since coming back from excursion. I figured this was going to be his year. This was Okada's second straight G1 win, his fourth overall. They went 34 minutes, just shy of the all-time G1 record. The story was Ospreay throwing everything he could at Okada to try to beat him cleanly for the first time, including moves from past Okada opponents. It's like the ghost of Christmas past for Okada. He used Tanahashi's high fly flow. He used the Styles Clash. He used Omega's V-Trigger. He tried for the One-Winged Angel. But it still wasn't enough. And it sucks that the fans were not allowed to do anything but clap. But clap their little hands off for these two is what they did. The two best wrestlers on the planet right now, as far as I'm concerned, Will Ospreay and Kazuchika Okada. And Ospreay still cannot beat Okada clean. I think his one victory was off a distraction. I think it'll pay off for him one day at the Tokyo Dome, where he will finally get that big, elusive, clean win over Okada. But for now, his bad luck continues. So that was number three. Then we get to number two. I originally had this in the number one spot, but it got bumped down to number two, which is not a bad place to be. And it was the best WWE match all year. From Clash at the Castle in Cardiff on September 3rd, Gunther against Sheamus for the Intercontinental Championship. I love that for the first time I can rank an Intercontinental title match this high up on my list. It was the best IC title match in years. And appropriate that in a year where we celebrated the 30th anniversary of the Bret Hart British Bulldog match at Wembley Stadium, right? One of the best Intercontinental, if not the best Intercontinental title match of all time, some might say, that we had Bret Hart in the crowd live to watch the best Intercontinental title match in the last 20 plus years. It's also the highest ranking that I have ever given to a match involving Sheamus, which is very cool to see the kind of career renaissance that he had this year at 44 years old, 13 years after he made his main roster debut. This was his best match in years, and to see Walter be the one to restore some prestige back to a title that I saw so many great matches for as a kid. The Intercontinental title means something again. Just the fact that it was even defended on a major show is an achievement, because before this, it had not been defended on a pay-per-view since last year's WrestleMania. This is a match I was looking forward to ever since Walter got called up to the main roster. Two guys that hit hard, and they beat the holy hell out of each other. With 60,000 people cheering hard to see Sheamus win his first Intercontinental title, which has eluded him his entire career, Walter would chop him, Sheamus would give it right back. The near falls were great, including a Celtic cross by Sheamus, the old Razor's Edge, but Gunther kicked out. There was a power bomb by Gunther, but After that, the camera work here was great. They zoomed in on Sheamus's face. He's shaking his head like, no, you're going to have to kill me to beat me. They zoomed in on Gunther's face. He was yelling. He was frustrated that he couldn't put this man away. And then the lariat followed. And finally, he was able to put down Sheamus. This was 20 minutes bell to bell of just greatness. And that doesn't even include the post-match after Imperium left and went to the back. Sheamus, he used the ropes to get back to his feet. His chest was just shredded and all bloodied. And this crowd gave him a standing ovation. For the first time in his career, Sheamus got a standing ovation. This was a fight to the finish. I cannot say enough good things about this. This right here is the WWE match of the year. And if that is the best WWE match of 2022, then the top spot belongs to the best trilogy of matches. And really, the best trilogy in wrestling since Omega and Okada. For the second straight year, tag team wrestling takes the number one spot on my countdown. Last year, it was the Lucha Bros and the Young Bucks in the cage at All Out. This year, the top spot belongs to FTR and the Briscoes. Top guys and dem boys. I'm lumping all three of their matches together because it's hard to rank them. And frankly, I didn't want them taking up three spots when it was hard enough to keep this list of 15 as it is. So am I cheating a little bit? Yes, but I don't give a shit. It's my list. Fuck off. We're putting all three matches together here in the number one spot. All three matches were contested for the Ring of Honor Tag Team Championship. First at Supercard of Honor back on April 1st, then at Death Before Dishonor on July 23rd, and their most recent match, the Double Dog Collar match at Final Battle on December 10th. What is amazing to me about all three of these matches being the best that I saw all year, because we talk so often about how it's important to build these matches up, right? What's the build like? What's the build going to be like this year for WrestleMania, right? You don't want to come in cold. We talk about that all the time, and I think it's a fair point to make. What's amazing about this is they did these three matches with absolutely no build on television whatsoever. There were some social media promos. That was it. There was no build on TV. Ring of Honor has no television show. Tony Khan wanted to have the Briscoes on AEW television, but Warner Brothers Discovery would not allow it because of a dumb tweet that Jay Briscoe posted in 2013. So there wasn't much build for any of these matches. In fact, the last one was just thrown together a few days before the show on Dynamite by Billy Gunn's kids, because the Briscoes were not allowed to be there themselves. So it was almost like Austin and Colton Gunn were the surrogates to basically announce the match or throw it to a Briscoes promo, or not a Briscoes promo, but to throw it to the announcement that this match was added to the final battle card. Now, I would say their second match was slightly better than their first, and their third was probably the best of all three, but they're all great in their own way. After their first match, I said it would be in the conversation for match of the year when this year was over. That was the night that Dax and Cash won the ROH tag team titles. Then came the second match, best two out of three falls, a 45-minute classic that saw FTR retain their titles. And then the dog collar match, which was a violent, bloody, brutal match. This was not a dance. This was a dangerous match to be in. This felt like a fight. And it saw the Briscoes finally regain the titles. They had to win. Tony Khan could not have the Briscoes drop three straight when they are exclusive to Ring of Honor. If FTR beats them in a clean sweep, they're still AEW guys. At the end of the day, they'll be on TBS and TNT most weeks. The Briscoes won't. So they had to win, and they did. Dave Meltzer called this the greatest chain match that he has ever seen. I can't think of one better. And that includes CM Punk and MJF, who had one this year that made this same list, which is another first. I don't think I've ever had a match of the year list with one dog collar match on it, let alone two. But this is a trilogy that will be talked about for years. Tag team wrestling at its finest. And that is your top 15 match of the year list for 2022, the 15 best matches that I saw all year. Now we have some awards to give out, as I do every year. Last year, I had an overall Wrestler of the Year honor, and then I broke it down by male and female categories. I'm not doing that this year. This year, I'm sticking to one single Wrestler of the Year winner. Last year, it was Bryan Danielson. 5 of the 15 spots on my Match of the Year list were occupied by Bryan Danielson. But what sealed it for me was the fact that he went from headlining WrestleMania and challenging for the WWE Championship or the Universal title, whatever it was. I think it was the Universal title. But he went from challenging for the top title in the company. And in the second half of last year, he did the exact same thing in AEW. And he was doing it at a level higher than he has maybe ever in his career. And he's had a long career. So that was impressive. To me, that makes you the wrestler of the year when you can pull that off. This year, there were 3 names that I was seriously considering for the award. Will Ospreay was one of those names because Ospreay in ring has had an incredible year. Better than anybody else. 4 of the 15 spots on this year's list are occupied by Will Ospreay, including the best match at Wrestle Kingdom, the best match at Forbidden Door, and the best matches in this year's G1. And if the emphasis is on in-ring work, it's hard to vote against Will Ospreay. Dax Harwood made a good case. He has had a career year for himself, not only with the Briscoes trilogy, but his Dynamite matches against the Young Bucks, against the Acclaimed. And he has had singles matches this year with CM Punk, with Cash Wheeler, with Adam Cole, with Jay Lethal, with Bryan Danielson, with Will Ospreay. The Ospreay match, not surprisingly, being the best of all the singles matches that Dax had this year. IWGP Tag Team Champion, AAA Tag Team Champion, former Ring of Honor Tag Team Champion. He held all but the AEW Tag Team titles this year. As great as his in-ring resume has been, and as great of a year as Ospreay has had. And if this was a kayfabe list, then Roman Reigns would be the runaway wrestler of the year. But this is not a kayfabe list. And Roman Reigns has worked a grand total of 7 singles matches on TV or pay-per-view all year. So I cannot rank him as the wrestler of the year. My wrestler of the year for 2022 is also this year's MVP for All Elite Wrestling. And that is Jon Moxley. Now, I don't have any set criteria for judging Wrestler of the Year. A lot of times it has to do with a person's body of work in the ring. I will note that Jon Moxley only appears once in my top 15 matches of the year, and that was for Anarchy in the Arena, which was an ensemble cast that they had. It included 9 other people. It's not about any one match this year. It's about the overall year that this man has had and how important he was to Tony Khan and the second biggest wrestling company in the world. This was the year that Jon Moxley planted his flag in the ground with AEW, and he signed a brand new 5-year contract to show where his loyalty lies. This man bleeds AEW. Literally, he bleeds all the time, everywhere. Moxley left rehab, and he made his return to television on January 19th. He was looking healthier and leaner than he has been in years. And in the promo he cut that night, he said that in 2022, he was going to grab the world of pro wrestling by the balls and do what he wants. And he lived up to his word. He has been a weekly staple on television. And it doesn't matter if it's big names like his match with Bryan Danielson at Revolution, or Quake by the Lake against Chris Jericho, or his all-out match with CM Punk, or Full Gear against MJF. Or the countless TV matches that he has had with names that are not as big, like Wheeler Yuta and Daniel Garcia and Brody King and Darius Martin, or Konosuke Takeshita on Rampage. And that was a hell of a match that those two had, even better than their first. He showed up, and he put the work in. There was no name too big or too small for Jon Moxley to work with. That is to say nothing of all the matches that he had on the indies this year, whether it was as GCW champion on, against Nick Gage, ripping his body to shreds, or wrestling men like Biff Busick or Speedball Mike Bailey. I mean, he tore it up all over the place this year. In multiple promotions for New Japan, against Will Ospreay and El Desperado and Juice Robinson. When CM Punk broke his foot and Tony Khan needed an interim AEW world champion to step in, who did he turn to save his main event for Forbidden Door? He turned to Jon Moxley, who beat Hiroshi Tanahashi to become the AEW world champion again. And he didn't stop. He was part of that Blood and Guts match. He defended the title against Rush at Fight for the Fallen. And then when CM Punk came back, he beat Punk in 3 minutes which set up their rematch at All Out, where Moxley did the job to get the belt back onto CM Punk. And he was supposed to go on vacation after that. I think he was going to go ice fishing with some friends. He was going to go on vacation until Muffin Man blew up at the media scrum and the Elite decided to confront him about it. Four of the top stars in the company, all of whom had just won titles that night, had them stripped away. And again, Tony Khan was left to call upon who else but Jon Moxley to save the day, like Mighty Mouse. Mighty Mox. We're going to start calling him Mighty Mox. So Moxley ended up with the AEW World title yet again. Had a great match with Bryan Danielson at Grand Slam. Defended the title on Dynamite against Hangman Page and Penta. And then he did the honors for MJF at Full Gear. This is a man who stepped up when AEW needed him. Not only in the ring, but behind the scenes as well. During probably the most chaotic period in the history of the company. They needed someone like Moxley. They needed a steady hand. And Tony Khan was very fortunate to have him. That is why Jon Moxley is the Wrestler of the Year for 2022. Tag Team of the Year honors go to FTR. Holding multiple tag team titles across different promotions, they owned the top spot for Match of the Year with the Briscoes for all three of their Ring of Honor matches. Their rematch with the Bucks, their match with the Acclaimed a few weeks ago, the match they had with Aussie Open that I heard so much about from the Royal Quest show. They were handpicked to be Ricky Steamboat's partners in his return match last month. They have had the best year of their careers. Maybe the best that they will ever have. I wouldn't say to them, hey, you guys have peaked. But it's possible we look back and say, this is the year that FTR peaked. Hopefully not. Hopefully they have an even better year next year. Now they're gearing up to defend their IWGP tag team belts at the Tokyo Dome for the first time. But the babyface run that they have been on and how the fans have taken to them has been so much fun to watch. And if FTR is the tag team of the year, then the Briscoes deserve an honorable mention for the year that they've had. They were part of those same three matches with FTR for the ROH tag team titles. They also had a banger with Aussie Open at the House of Glory show in October. And a lot of other great matches in HOG as well that I know a lot of people didn't see, but I did. I was ringside for those matches against teams like United Empire and Main Event, who just beat the Briscoes for the House of Glory tag team titles. I got to see those matches up close, and they were great. And you could even take it back to the start of the year and them winning this year's NWA Crockett Cup. The Briscoes have had a hell of a run this year, too, which is worth mentioning. There were some great pay-per-views this year. I thought WrestleMania was a lot of fun. This was probably the best WrestleMania, honestly, since 31. Clash at the Castle. Another very good show. Full Gear was one of the best AEW shows that they've done. But there was no better wrestling pay-per-view this year than Forbidden Door in June. I had been waiting for an AEW New Japan super show since this company was first formed, and there were politics that didn't allow for it to happen until now. CM Punk's injury threw a wrench into things, but what we ended up with was a card that did not have a single bad match on the entire show. We had FTR winning the IWGP tag team titles, an excellent four-way for the All-Atlantic Championship with Pac winning the title. Will Ospreay and Orange Cassidy, they stole the show, and the Shibata cameo after was tremendous. Getting to see Sting as tag team partners with Shingo Takagi, that was a trip. Thunder Rosa and Tony Storm, they had a good match. Claudio debuting as the replacement for Bryan Danielson against Zack Sabre Jr. was the perfect choice. Tony Khan wasn't planning on debuting him until the ROH pay-per-view in July. But injuries really wreaked havoc on this card, so he had to readjust. And that may be the most impressive thing about this show, is how badly they were plagued by injuries, and yet they still turned out the best show all year. The IWGP title four-way was very good until the finish and the injury to Adam Cole. And then Moxley beating Tanahashi in the main event. He finally got the match he wanted for years with Tanahashi. This was a show where they did not even have CM Punk. They did not have Bryan Danielson and they did not have Kenny Omega. Imagine if they did. This year, we should have Danielson and Omega in the mix. And hopefully we get Okada against one of them. But for all the great pay-per-views that we got, there was some stinkers. And the worst of them all in 2022, I'm sorry to say, was the Royal Rumble. And that sucks, because I love the Royal Rumble, and I'm hoping that Triple H is extra motivated to make his first Royal Rumble as the head of creative next month a fun one. But the men's Royal Rumble match this year was one of the most boring matches that I have ever seen. The Brock Lesnar-Bobby Lashley match, that's a match I waited a long time for. That ended up being a disappointment. The Roman Reigns-Seth Rollins match was very good. That was the only really good thing on the entire show. And I love Rollins playing mind games with Roman by resurrecting the old Shield entrance out of the crowd. But overall, this was the most disappointing event of the year for me. Rookie of the Year. I don't always do Rookie of the Year, but I thought it was appropriate to give out a Rookie of the Year award this year. And really, Rookie of the Year comes down to just two people. Bron Breakker or Logan Paul. I was tempted to go with Logan Paul, but I ended up going with Bron Breakker. Even though he debuted on NXT last year, this was his first full year on TV and his first full year as the top star of basically his own brand. And he has improved a lot from where he was on day one. Logan Paul has been a revelation since WrestleMania when he tagged with The Miz against the Mysterios. Then he wrestled Miz at SummerSlam one-on-one, and he impressed me even more. Then he got thrown to the lions with Roman Reigns for the championship in Saudi Arabia, and they hit a grand slam. If he commits to this, Logan Paul could be a future world champion. Bron Breakker already is a champion. He will absolutely be a future world champion. There is no if. Bron Breakker will be a world champion on Raw or SmackDown one day. Logan Paul has wrestled all of three matches, which is only one less than Miro has had all year. Think about that. But he's wrestled three matches this year. And that's his entire career portfolio, are the three matches he had this year. Bron Breakker has been wrestling every single week. He's been putting the work in. He's been getting better. I like the vignettes they did with him leading up to the match with Apollo Crews. So I think his character work has gotten better as well. But he's there every week, you know, having good matches. And Logan Paul needs more than three matches that I'm sure he rehearsed for weeks in advance to qualify over Braun as the Rookie of the Year. But I would put Logan at number two. You know, Hook may have ended up on my list. I wouldn't have put Hook at number one, but Hook could have been a solid number two. You know, maybe he is number three. But the booking with Hook, I mean, he got hot and then he disappeared. I mean, he was hot for a minute and the fans still like him, but he kind of vanished there for a while. So I couldn't really seriously consider him for the number one spot on this list, but to me it comes down to either Braun or Logan Paul, and like I said, I would go with Bron Breakker. Now, as far as most improved this year, that would go to Tiffany Stratton, you know, before she got hurt. Literally had her first match 13 months ago, and you could see the improvement in her just from the first half of this year to where she was in the summer. And if she can get better that quickly, imagine how good she can be a few years from now. And then we get to the biggest story. What is the biggest story and the most shocking story of 2022? This is a no-brainer. This has been the wildest year ever in wrestling. It has been an exhausting 5 years since January 1st. But the biggest story of the year, by far, is Vince McMahon resigning as the chairman and CEO of WWE and Triple H taking over as the new head of creative. There was no bigger story in wrestling all year, or the past decade plus, for that matter. When you think about wrestling, and you think about WWE, it's always been about Vince, right? Everything's revolved around Vince McMahon. And we have talked about this, and I have covered this on the podcast. I've been doing this show for 15 years. And especially in the last few years, especially on Monday Night Raw over the last 5 years, maybe longer. We've talked about how the quality of the shows have gone down. At one point, Raw was the worst show on television. And unfortunately, although there was some improvement over the summer, Raw has kind of faded. I don't know if I would call it the worst show on TV, but it's pretty close to where it was before. But we've talked about all the issues with Vince McMahon and his booking and the people that he would push and the people that he wouldn't push and wouldn't call up or that he would release and the stories about him, you know, throwing out the scripts hours before the show and blowing it up, and then why even have a creative team? And it just, these stories would come out, and it would sound like a fucking nightmare to work for this guy. But you would watch the product on TV, and there were things that you can, you know, pick out of it that you liked, and we had this great WrestleMania this year. But for the most part, for a while now, it was a case where this was a company in dire need of a new creative vision. Because you've had the same person in the chair for decades. And now he's 77 years old. And at what point do you realize, hey, it's time to maybe go in a different direction? Yeah, it's his company, but we sure could use a fresh pair of eyes and a fresh creative vision for this show, a new showrunner. But we were never going to get that. Unless Vince McMahon died or retired, and he was never, the thought was, he would never retire. And I'll guarantee you, I mean, there was never going to be a Vince McMahon retirement were it not for the controversy that popped up this year with the women and the hush money payments and the potential devastating impact that could have had on the stock. And Vince McMahon obviously felt like to save his company or to not be a burden on his company, he was advised the best thing to do would be to step down and step away. And that's what he did. Against his wishes, and now he might tell you against his better judgment, he stepped down and he stepped away. And his daughter is now the co-CEO of the company with Nick Khan. Triple H has ascended to the position that we always imagined he would end up in up until the last few years, especially when he got sick and almost died last year. It looked like, you know, Triple H was never going to ascend to that position. At one time, it was a no-brainer. Triple H and Stephanie, they're the heir apparents. They're going to take over one day. And then it became like, you know what? This doesn't look like it's going to happen. Triple H almost fucking died last year. And then Vince McMahon dismantled almost his entire team in NXT and blew the whole fucking thing up. Then his own daughter says, oh, I'm going to step away and take a leave of absence. And they buried her on the way out in some of the business trades. So Triple H had this serious health episode. He was out of the picture for months. Stephanie steps away. It looked like the succession plan was blown to pieces. Nobody knew what the future of this company looked like. And to see how things have ended up here, as we sit here at the end of this year, with Vince out of the picture, supposedly thinking about trying to claw his way back into the picture, but him being out of the picture, Stephanie being the CEO, Triple H being the head of creative, and putting his stamp on things and bringing back people that Vince fired and trying new concepts that Vince never would have tried on the main roster, like War Games and the Fight Pit and some of this other stuff. It is amazing to see how things have changed in such a short period of time. But the best thing to happen to WWE in forever was Vince McMahon going away. Which is why when I talked about the Wall Street Journal story, you know, last week, the week before, whatever it was, I said the best thing that Vince could do if he really cares about WWE is to stay the fuck away. Nothing good can come from him going back to the same position that he was in before. I don't care what you think of the job that Triple H has done so far. Bringing back Vince McMahon, the one who got us in this position in the first place where people were begging for change, is not the right answer. Going back to the old way is not the right answer. And it's the best thing that has happened to this company in ages. Because now there's actually the potential for real change. We have not seen what a Triple H booked Royal Rumble looks like. We have not seen what a Triple H booked WrestleMania is going to look like. He has not even been in this position for one full year. Vince McMahon had 40 of them. So I'm willing to give it time to see a year from now what Triple H's WWE looks like, as compared to what it looks like right now. There have been positive changes made. There have been some not so positive changes made. There have been returns that I agreed with, and there have been returns that have been duds. But the fact that Vince McMahon is no longer in charge, if you would have said that to me 6 months ago, or 8 months ago, or a year ago, when I did my year in review show last year in 2021, I would have told you were out of your fucking mind. Nothing can take this man down, except Vince McMahon. He took himself down. And that is the biggest story of this year, because this will have repercussions on the wrestling business, not just his company, but the entire industry going forward. We've already seen it with people willing to come back and wanting to come back to work for WWE because Vince McMahon is gone. And maybe now things will be different, or maybe they didn't get along with Vince McMahon, or they thought Vince McMahon didn't like them. So people who otherwise would have stayed in AEW or signed with AEW maybe now will come to WWE. Triple H, I'm sure, is already making great plans to expand into other territories. He's talked about opening performance centers in NXT, NXT Japan, NXT Europe is supposedly going to launch at some point next year. And the jury is out on how positive that's going to be for those places. I don't think that's going to be a very, very good thing for those places at all. For WWE, it might be, but not for those areas that they're basically going to be invading. But we're looking at a completely different wrestling landscape now than we did at the beginning of this year, which is exciting to think about, because at least it's something different. At least we might actually see things that we never would have seen under Vince McMahon. Now there's real hope that we might be able to see those things. That is the biggest story of this year, and it's not even close. But that it was hardly the only big story this year. There has been no shortage of crazy stories in 2022. We have the media scrum. The media scrum from hell at Brawl Out, which would have been number one were it not for the Vince McMahon stuff. With CM Punk's gripe bomb, as some people are calling it, the fallout from what happened that night, CM Punk wins back the AEW World Championship in Chicago, in his hometown. MJF returns to the company. The Elite, right? They win the Trios titles. Kenny Omega had only recently come back after being gone for almost a year. This should have been a joyous time for AEW and Tony Khan, who we didn't learn until much later on was going through his own personal crisis at that time behind the scenes with his mother, who we almost lost. So this should have been a happy time for AEW, and instead, the company devolved seemingly into chaos. And there was question about whether or not they'd even be able to recover from this, because in one night, they lost four of their biggest names. They just crowned four new champions. Matt Jackson, Nick Jackson, Kenny Omega, CM Punk all had new hardware when that night was over. And before the week was even over, they were all stripped. And Tony Khan had to rethink what his direction was going to be heading into the fall now for his company. He had to call upon Jon Moxley. He had to take things in a different direction. And that could have been devastating to this company. Some people say that it is devastating to the company. They lost CM Punk, who would have been gone anyway because he got hurt. But, oh, you know, their ratings have suffered as a result, as if Punk was drawing million-dollar audiences every week. Nobody is doubting the ratings and business impact that CM Punk did have. I think people are also overstating it when they talk about how, you know, oh, they'll never get to a million consistently again, and they'll never do this and they'll never do that, as if they were doing that all the time when Punk was still there. It's a big blow. There's no doubt about it. Punk did good business for AEW. Tony Khan defended him like you would never believe after the Double or Nothing scrum against the criticism that Eric Bischoff had leveled at CM Punk not being a draw. And Tony Khan went off on him for it. So he definitely had a positive impact on business. Losing him is going to hurt the company. But it was the right move to make, because you can't do what Punk did in the media scrum and embarrass the company and embarrass the head of that company the way that he did and not have consequences for that. Just because you're the top star in the company, you should not be excused from that. So he lost a lot of big stars in one fell swoop, and it wasn't about what a great show they had. It was about all the bullshit that came after the show and all the drama that came out of it and the investigation and all of the nonsense. That is not something that Tony Khan needed. It was not something that made Tony Khan look good as he sat there and just listened to Punk going on about somebody who wasn't even on the fucking show, who had nothing to do with the show, going off on Scott Colton. Who gives a shit? Talking about politics and talking about people talking behind his back, whether it's true or not, it was not the right forum for him to air those grievances. We had Festivus on Friday. That's when you air the grievances. You don't air the grievances at the post-show scrum on what should have been a happy night for AEW. We had Tony Khan buying Ring of Honor from Sinclair Broadcast Group. Tony Khan was a huge fan of Ring of Honor back in the day. He did not want to see Ring of Honor fall into the hands of Vince McMahon and WWE and turned into a tab on Peacock. He wanted to try to preserve the legacy of Ring of Honor and breathe new life into the company when clearly Sinclair was not going to do that. Sinclair basically shut down Ring of Honor. It was supposed to be a temporary shutdown at the end of last year. But I think when it happened, a lot of people, myself included, looked at that and said, yeah, they claim they'll be back up and running in April, but I had my doubts. Tony Khan evidently had his doubts. So he swooped in and he bought Ring of Honor and he went on Dynamite back at the beginning of March and he made that big announcement at Daly's Place. You know, the name on the contract isn't Shane. It's not Shane. It's me. He's such a nerd, but he's a wrestling nerd, right? He loves wrestling. He's the big super fan who's throwing his money around and he thinks that he could help revive Ring of Honor, which is something that has yet to happen. He tried to get a television deal for them. He was unsuccessful. Ring of Honor is not going to have a show on Honor Club if they have interest from an actual television network. So he tried, and so far he failed, to secure a television deal. Ring of Honor still has no weekly show. They will in 2023. What that will look like, we don't know yet. The jury is still out on whether or not this is going to be a success. It may not be viable. Who knows if Ring of Honor will still be run as a separate entity a year from now. Tony Khan is also a businessman, and if it's not working, at some point he may have to pull the plug. I used to be a Ring of Honor fan as well. Some of the most fun experiences that I've ever had at a wrestling show came at live Ring of Honor shows in the mid-2000s. So I have a place in my heart in wrestling fandom for Ring of Honor, just like a lot of other people do. But can Ring of Honor be sustained as its own separate entity? I don't know. Tony Khan has a tough hill to climb if he's going to make that work, especially with all the attention that he has to pay to AEW and talent that isn't being used, and when stuff like the media scrum comes up, that's where his focus needs to be. So is he going to bring in somebody to kind of help oversee things with Ring of Honor? I mean, we don't know. There's still a lot of questions that are unanswered about this, how big of a story this will truly end up being, because right now it just feels more like a vanity project than anything else. But at the time when he announced it, that was big news. And there were a lot of fans who were very excited to see what he would do with it. I think a lot of those fans, their excitement waned when they saw that AEW was being turned into Ring of Honor on some weeks. That's not what they wanted. But what 2023 holds for ROH, we have to wait and see. And then there's Cody Rhodes, one of the founding fathers and EVPs of AEW, leaving the company. He becomes the first EVP to leave, to go back to WWE. This was a shocking story because I think a lot of people didn't actually think that this would happen. There were rumors about it. There were people joking about how we're going to see Cody in the Royal Rumble. And even I kind of knocked those rumors and said, yeah, okay, you'll see me in the Royal Rumble this year before you see Cody Rhodes. Cody Rhodes did not make the Royal Rumble, but Cody Rhodes was at WrestleMania. And he made a hell of a return. And when he came back, this was not the same Cody Rhodes that left the company 6 years ago. This was not stardust. He came back and he felt like a star. He went away and he showed Vince McMahon, look, this is what I can do. I can be a main event star. I can be a top attraction for you. Just give me the chance. He had unfinished business in this company. He didn't like the way that he left WWE in the first place. And whatever the issues were that led to him deciding, I have to leave here and I'm going to go back to WWE, that was a huge loss for Tony Khan. And it was a huge loss for what it said, which is that if Cody could leave, then anybody can leave. Because Cody, you would look at him and think, this guy's going to be AEW for life. He was one of the founding fathers of this company. He was the one going on television and taking little pot shots and digs at WWE, and yet he's the first one to go back. So for as much as what it represents about the pendulum starting to swing in the other direction, so much of that talent, it was pretty much all going in one direction, right? They were fleeing WWE and they were going the other way. All of a sudden, it felt like the pendulum is starting to swing in the other direction. And Cody, before he got hurt, it was only a few months, but he was having a hell of a run. Undefeated, going out there, having great matches with Seth Rollins. He had that performance at Hell in a Cell. He's going to come back. Cody Rhodes is going to be the WWE champion. As soon as WrestleMania this year, Cody Rhodes will be the WWE champion. So for him, it's been a huge change. But for AEW, it was a huge loss. We had William Regal. William Regal started the year fired by WWE. He got swept up in that whole mess of everybody being let go from Triple H's team down at NXT. He got fired. Then he signed with AEW. Then he asked to leave AEW a few months ago. And he ends 2022 back in WWE. He doesn't officially start until the first week of next year. But he has an agreement in place to go back to WWE, this time as a vice president. So think about that as a year. Fired by WWE, signs with AEW, leaves AEW, ends up back in WWE, all in the same calendar year. I don't think anybody would have predicted any of that. Nobody would have predicted that Regal would get fired in the first place. Nobody would have expected him to show up in AEW. And then nobody would have predicted that he'd be back in WWE by now. But here we are. One of those years, right? Too bad, because Regal could have been, I think, a very positive influence behind the scenes in that. As much as I enjoy him as an on-air character, we're not going to be seeing him on television for quite a while. Because per his contract, he will not be allowed to appear on television for at least a year. As much as I enjoy William Regal on screen, he could have been a very positive influence for a very long time for Tony Khan behind the scenes. His loss is WWE's gain. But it shouldn't be that much of a surprise. Triple H loves Regal. He's been friends with Regal. Regal looked out for him when he was in WCW back in the mid-90s. Regal is sort of one of his chief lieutenants. You know, I made the comparison several weeks ago. I said he could be to Triple H what Pat Patterson was effectively to Vince McMahon. Or you could say Bruce Pritchard. I kind of looked at it as a Patterson and Vince thing. But here we are. And Regal is going to be a VP now in WWE. We had Sasha Banks and Naomi, the women's tag team champions in WWE, walking out of the company on a Monday night before Raw, a Raw show they were supposed to be on. They put their belts down on Johnny Ace's desk, and they walk out of the company, still to this day, never to return. And now Sasha Banks is going to be showing up at Wrestle Kingdom for New Japan next week. So that was a big story when it broke. We covered it at length. We have not seen Naomi since then. Sasha, I mean, there's been rumors about Sasha all year. Now, finally, we have a sense of what her future is going to be. She's going to be free. As of the first of this year, as of next weekend, she's going to be a free woman. And I think 2023 is going to be the year of Mercedes. I think we're going to see this woman pop up in a lot of places. And potentially, you know, she'll end up back in WWE at some point. But why not play the field? Right? Call your own shots. Do what you want. Now is the time. Try to blow up your name as much as possible. Because she doesn't need WWE, and WWE doesn't really need her, but they would certainly benefit by having Sasha Banks, and losing Sasha Banks is a major loss for the WWE women's division. So I am excited to see what her 2023 is going to look like. But them walking out was a very big story when it happened back in May. Feels like a lifetime ago. Speaking of feeling like a lifetime ago, I've mentioned all of these stories, and only now am I getting to the fact that Stone Cold Steve Austin returned to the ring after a 19-year absence to wrestle Kevin Owens in the main event of WrestleMania. We got Stone Cold back in the ring in the main event of WrestleMania. And what is this? I have this, I mean, I'm not ranking these, but I'm only getting to this, like the fifth or sixth or maybe seventh biggest story of the year. It's crazy. But it really happened. And Austin looked good. He looks even better now. You check out his training videos on Instagram. Boy, he's in full training mode. He's getting ready for something. We had MJF and the AEW drama around Double or Nothing, where he no-showed a meet and greet that weekend. He supposedly got into a shouting match with Tony Khan. It led to him booking a flight home that I don't believe he ended up being on. But we weren't sure if he would show up to do the job for Wardlow that weekend. He did. He took the 10 power bombs. But what should have been the biggest match of Wardlow's career was completely overshadowed by all the drama involving MJF, which then led to the infamous promo where he called Tony Khan a fucking mark on live TV. And by that point, you know, I'm sure it was pretty clear at that point that this was all part of a larger angle. I don't think it started that way. I do believe that there was probably discontent between the two sides, and MJF may have wanted more money. He probably got what he wanted. Then they turned it into an angle. but I don't believe it started that way. I don't doubt that there was real life tension there between the two sides. And there were legitimate questions about what, if any, future would he have in AEW. But the one I feel really bad for out of all this, because he didn't do anything wrong, and he really got fucked over because of all of this, and never recovered, was Wardlow. After being released by WWE late last year, Jeff Hardy made his debut for AEW, to much fanfare. But it was short-lived after getting popped for his third DUI in 10 years. He was pulled from TV, he got sent to rehab, still has a court date pending. They keep pushing back and pushing back this pretrial hearing. I feel like they're just going to keep pushing it back until the end of time. He just got another delay until next month. But he still has this legal matter, this court date hanging over his head, which will determine what his future in AEW looks like. He could still end up behind bars before all is said and done. But if history is any guide when it comes to Jeff Hardy, he'll probably get off with a slap on the wrist. After 413 days as the NXT Women's Champion, and having the best run of her career, Mandy Rose fired by WWE, right? We couldn't end this year without at least one big story in the month of December. You got to have at least one per month. That was the big story of this month. That caught a lot of people by surprise. It caught me by surprise that she even had a fan time page. Right? The more you know. Shane McMahon returned to WWE at the Royal Rumble and then was promptly sent home by Vince McMahon. Sent home by his father. Sent to his room. There were WrestleMania plans in place for Shane. Elimination Chamber, he was supposed to be part of that match. It all got wiped out because he showed up at the Royal Rumble. He was helping to book the Royal Rumble and he was being a disruptive force. He was trying to make himself look good at the expense of others, and Vince McMahon said, "Get your ass out of here. That's cold." Basically fired his own son. Fired his own son, and then when she announced her leave of absence, buried his own daughter on her way out of the company. Cold. He's a cold man. Big E broke his neck on SmackDown before WrestleMania this year. He was in a match, got dropped on his head outside by Ridge Holland. That could have been a lot worse than it was. As bad as it was, it could have been tragic. And not only was he okay and breathing and talking that night, but now he's moving around normal. He's out of the neck brace and moving around like a normal person, but we still have no idea if he'll ever be able to get back in the ring. And he recently said that he will not even have a scan and an evaluation until they hit the 1 year mark, which again, I believe is in March. They won't even know until then what his wrestling future may or may not look like. I look at this and I say, if he never wrestles another match again, as long as he can live a normal, healthy, pain-free life, to me, that's the most important thing. And he has basically said as much, like whatever's going to be is going to be. He's at peace with it. You know, hey, he could always say he was WWE champion. But that was a very scary situation. Thankfully, he's doing better, but what his future looks like, completely up in the air. AEW and New Japan, they had the Forbidden Door pay-per-view with Tanahashi and Okada, each making their Dynamite debuts in the weeks leading up to the show. We talked about the Forbidden Door and what a big show that was. Nick Aldis had a very public split with the NWA. And Billy Corgan disgraced his company by putting Tyrus on top as the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. Kairi became the first ever IWGP Women's Champion. We had the death of the NXT UK brand. We had the death of the 24/7 Championship, the one death I can get behind this year. And unfortunately, we had the death of Scott Hall back in March, and the death of Antonio Inoki back in October. Two very big names that the wrestling world lost this year. So as I said, this will go down as the craziest year that I can remember in wrestling. A lot of positive things happened this year. A lot of negative things happened this year. There's good, there's bad. But if there's one thing you could say about 2022, it was not a boring year. If you have questions for the mailbag, you could email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I should mention that next Sunday is New Year's Day, and it's going to be my annual prediction show. We got the year-end awards here and the top matches of the year this week for the Christmas show. Next Sunday, we're going to be doing predictions, not only for 2023, but for Wrestle Kingdom as well, because that week is the Wrestle Kingdom show. But we do this every year. I review what I got right with my predictions for this past year and what I got wrong. And then I offer my prediction for the year ahead. So for those of you wondering, when am I doing the prediction show? That will be next Sunday. So let's start here with Michael from Long Island. If you had to choose, do you think it's more likely that Alexa Bliss wins the Raw Women's Championship on the January 2nd Raw and then probably drops it back at the Royal Rumble, or Alexa loses on that Raw and then wins the title of the Rumble as a fully dark Alexa? I don't think Alexa wins the championship at all, but of those two options, I think option A is more likely than option B, because I don't see Alexa Bliss going into WrestleMania as the Raw Women's Champion. I think it's Bianca Belair defending probably against Rhea Ripley, but whether it's Rhea, whether it's Charlotte, I don't see Bianca not being in the women's title match at WrestleMania. Bianca Belair, back-to-back WrestleManias now, has won the Women's Championship. Bianca Belair has been on top on that show and in that division all year long. I don't know what you would do with her this close to WrestleMania if all of a sudden she dropped the title and wasn't either defending it or challenging for it. And if they're doing Bianca and Alexa now, they're not doing it again at WrestleMania. So I don't think she's losing the title here. But if she was going to, I could see her losing it to Alexa and then getting it right back at the Rumble. Jared from Orlando. What happened to Sheamus as a top guy? I actually enjoyed his babyface run on SmackDown and World Heavyweight Championship run, but it seems ever since he returned in 2015 as a heel, he lost all his momentum, and every year since he has gone further and further down the card. I know recently he has been getting over with the Brawling Brutes in his match with Walter at Clash at the Castle, but do you think we'll ever see Sheamus back on top of the main event scene anytime soon? I think we'll see Sheamus challenge for the top title eventually again. I think he would be a good opponent for Roman Reigns, frankly. If they needed somebody to put him in the ring with between now and WrestleMania, it looks like Kevin Owens is going to get that spot at the Royal Rumble. Sheamus being on top as the guy, or a top guy, world champion, getting another big run, I don't see it. Especially anytime soon, the answer is no, I don't see it. I think he... You know, he has been in that position at times, but he's also, you know, he's getting older and he's been with the company now. He's had one of these like Dolph Ziggler, Kofi Kingston runs where he's been there for so long. And you could say that about Miz as well. He's in that same category, Miz and Sheamus and Kofi and Ziggler, where they have been there for so long. I just think they end up settling into this role where, you know, the company can look at them and say, hey, we're going to use these guys to help get over other talent. That's what they're doing with Dolph. That's basically how they're using Miz now. And I think they kind of look at Sheamus in a similar way. He's in a better spot than they are. But I think they kind of look at him in the same way. You know, an age alone is not an excuse. I mean, Bobby Lashley, I think, is older than, you know, than Sheamus is. But... Do I see him getting a run like that, like he had back then, 2015? No, I think that time has come and gone. Dylan, and by the way, there's one other note here. He's got spinal stenosis, so I don't know long-term what his plans are, as far as how much longer he plans to go, how much longer his body will allow for him to go, because he has the same condition that, you know, Edge has and Stone Cold had. And they've made comebacks, but that's to do matches here and there. Right? They still, their full-time careers came to an end, and Sheamus has the same condition, so we don't know how many more years he'll even be doing this for. I don't think that 2, 3, 4 years from now, the company is going to suddenly vault Sheamus into a top spot, make him a world champion, and give him a 6-month run. I just don't see that. Dylan from Toronto has a couple of New Japan questions. In the not-so-distant future, do you see New Japan booking the Wrestle Kingdom main event with Shingo Takagi and Will Ospreay for the IWGP World Heavyweight Championship? And if yes, how soon? I could absolutely see that as a Wrestle Kingdom main event. But if you're expecting it in the next year or two, I would not hold my breath. I think there's a much better chance, because there's a story that they're telling with Okada and Ospreay. And Ospreay still cannot get that one big clean win over Okada. I think we're likely to see that in the main event of the Tokyo Dome before we ever get Ospreay and Shingo. But could I see Ospreay and Shingo maybe the year after that? in a Tokyo Dome main event? Yeah, but I think you're looking 2-3 years down the road. Also, do you ever see Zack Sabre Jr. as a top champion in New Japan, or is his size holding him back? I think the size does hold him back a little bit. I just don't see him as the IWGP champion. I don't see him in that role. I don't see it. Alvin from Fayetteville, North Carolina. I was asked a question by a friend of mine that knows I am a Bret Hart fan like you. He asked me, who is the modern day Bret Hart? I stopped and thought about it for a second and I answered AJ Styles or Dax Harwood. So I would love to hear your opinion on that and who you believe is the modern day Bret Hart. You know, I see this come up sometimes. There is no one person that I see who I immediately point to and say, he's the modern day Bret Hart. Because there is none. Bret was just built different. You know, as seriously as he treated it, the way that he sold, the psychology of pro wrestling. I mean, I saw Meltzer once say that Tanahashi was the modern day Bret Hart. What's funny about that is that Tanahashi has cited Shawn Michaels as his inspiration. But I see more Bret in him than I do Shawn. Like, I could see why Meltzer would say that. But the man who comes the closest, if I had to pick one name, is Bryan Danielson. He's a more fiery babyface than Bret was. He's a more vicious heel than Bret was. But one of the things I loved about Bryan's matches last year in AEW when he first came in was how he was finding different ways to finish his opponents. He was finding different ways to win. No two finishes were the same. It was different each time. That reminded me a lot of Bret. Bret did not win every match with the sharpshooter. You know, in a couple of matches, he used the victory roll. In another match, he used the La Mahistral cradle. And in a couple of others, he used the push off the ropes out of a sleeper hold. Yeah, the match with Bulldog at Wembley. He lost that match, but that finish was his idea. He always tried to change it up. And I think like Brian, he tried to make his stuff look as realistic as possible. He was a wrestler. Just like Brian is a wrestler. There's nothing overly flashy about either one of them, but you mention their names and they're always in the conversation of the greatest workers in the ring. So I think Danielson would be the closest one. Julius from the Bronx. If Stone Cold does not turn heel at WrestleMania 17, then Triple H turns babyface like he originally wanted, and he does not tear his quad. How would WWE have been different in the months and years ahead? I don't even know if Triple H wanted to turn babyface. I know that was the plan that was rumored coming out of WrestleMania, that he would work with Austin. They did the two-man power trip, and even then, I think the plan was to split them off and probably feud them at SummerSlam that year. How different things would have been in the years ahead? I think long term, it wouldn't have made a difference. I don't think things would have been radically different. But yeah, I mean, in the short term, remember you had the invasion. You had the WCW invasion that happened in 2001. Triple H missed that whole thing because he tore his quad. So if Triple H is there, that means he's part of the invasion. I've always thought that he would have ended up being the mole, who looked like he was joining the alliance, but he was really kind of working undercover for Vince McMahon, and he can help save the day in the end for WWE. So I always thought that role would have gone to him and not Kurt Angle had he been part of that whole thing. And I think Jericho probably would have been the odd man out, because Jericho was on the team, I think, at the Invasion pay-per-view. And there's no way, if Triple H is not hurt, there's no way Chris Jericho gets that spot. It would have been Triple H. It would have been Austin. It would have been Undertaker, Kane, Angle, and Triple H. And Jericho would have been the odd man out. So I think in the short term, yeah, it would have had some impact and changed a few things around. But like long term, years ahead, I don't see how it would have made any difference. Daniel from Memphis, Tennessee. Been a long-time listener since 2014. Can you explain the Public Enemy Steiner Brothers table botch on Nitro? Was there heat on Public Enemy and Ted DiBiase, or was it Rick Steiner's fault? So, to explain what he's talking about here, there was a Philadelphia street fight. I had to go back to look up the date, because they had a lot of matches together, but there was a Philadelphia street fight on the November 3rd, 1997 episode of WCW Monday Nitro. The Steiners and Public Enemy, they worked together a lot in their time in WCW. They had a bunch of matches, but it was their street fight. And they did a spot where they had two tables stacked up one on top of the other outside the ring. Rocco Rock bent Rick Steiner over. That sounds very dirty, but he bent him over so that he was sandwiched in between the two tables, if you can visualize this. Okay, so Rick is standing up, and now he's hunched over, and his body, his torso, is in between the two tables. So he wasn't, like, laying across the table or anything like that. Meanwhile, Johnny Grunge goes up to the top rope, and the idea was he was going to dive through the tables. The spot was Ted DiBiase, who was managing the Steiners at the time, which always felt very weird to me, especially after seeing the Steiners against Money Inc. feud in WWE and trade the tag team titles back and forth. To see DiBiase managing Rick and Scott was very bizarre. But DiBiase was supposed to pull Rick Steiner out of harm's way before Johnny Grunge crashed through the tables. It looked to me, you know, when I go back and watch it, like DiBiase hesitated. And he just didn't pull Steiner out of the way in time. So when you watch it back, again, I don't blame Rick Steiner or Johnny Grunge for that. It looked like it was DiBiase's job to pull Rick out of the way, and he just didn't do it in time. So Grunge crashed through the tables, and Steiner, yeah, he pulled himself away, but he almost lost his ear. Even though he had the amateur headgear on, he almost lost his ear. He came up all bloody from around the ear. Clearly, he was not very happy. Whether there was heat on Public Enemy for it when they got to the back, I wasn't in the back, so I don't know. But the Steiners looked pissed, and that probably wasn't a very happy meeting in the back. Like, if I was in a match with the Steiner brothers, and I did something that I thought pissed them off, and they looked angry, and they went to the back, like, I might not want to go through the curtain. I might want to take a detour through the crowd, take a taxi, go back to the hotel, let them cool off. But Public Enemy, I mean, they just couldn't catch a break between this and the incident with the APA when they went to WWE a few years later. You know, Public Enemy got the table gimmick over on a national scale before the Dudleys ever did. So, I mean, they had that going for them, but it just seemed like trouble followed them. Once they left ECW, like, trouble just followed them wherever they went. So anyway, thank you for the questions. I'm going to tie up Santa's sack over here, get to more questions next week. Keep emailing me, thesolemnmonster@gmail.com. Also, check out the House of Glory Christmas special, which is going up on YouTube. It may already be up on their YouTube channel right now, at House of Glory Wrestling. It includes two championship matches from our most recent show and a six-way number one contenders match that featured Santa Claus, which is definitely one of the weirdest matches that I've ever called. But one of the title matches going up is for the women's championship between Violet and Masha Slamovich. Watch that match, because that match was awesome. So that should be up on the HOG YouTube channel sometime today. Next week, as I said, there will be a sound off. That'll be episode 789. We're going to be doing predictions for 2023, looking back on the predictions I made for 2022. I'll probably have Wrestle Kingdom predictions next week as well. So that'll be a fun show. And of course, this week, live after Dynamite, live after SmackDown, live. The plan right now is to go live on New Year's Eve, Saturday night. So if you are available, if you are free, if you want to come hang out, spend some time ringing the new year, there'll be a lot of fun stuff coming up this week. And of course, brand new RSPW Rewind hitting the channel for channel members on YouTube tonight. And then Monday night for everybody else. My father would have turned 65 years old tomorrow. So I want to say happy birthday, Dad. And I leave you with this special year-end compilation produced by the one and only Noah Mark. Merry Christmas, everybody.
The Solomonster sounds off.
You're not cool. Nobody thinks you're cool. Stop trying to be cool.
Yeah, it's like that.
Fuck off. Beth Phoenix is standing in the aisle. If I was having a backyard bar.
barbecue for Memorial Day, and I needed something to weigh down the tablecloth because it was too windy outside, I would want to have those women's tag belts to weigh it down and make sure that all my napkins and all my paper plates wouldn't go flying into my neighbor's yard.
I don't watch fucking Friends. How the fuck am I supposed to know about the barista from Friends? I'm a Seinfeld guy. I don't watch Friends. Don't have them, don't need them, don't watch them.
I will tell you, do you know the one pie that was completely devoured when the night was over?
My pie.
The pecan pie was the one that went first. See? Salamaster brings the good shit. I bring only the best. I had my trusty voodoo doll. And when Goldberg went to pick up Roman Reigns for that jackhammer, I went, right there. And Goldberg stumbled, and he dropped Roman Reigns. The voodoo doll saved us from a Bill Goldberg Universal Championship win. I am convinced of that. Are you out of your fucking mind? Don't tell me what I can and cannot say.
Holy shit, what has happened to wrestling? What has happened to this fucking company? How did we get from that to this?
This show is a joke. Joke.
Maybe, just maybe,
leave the fucking dogs at home.
We've got Ice Mocha. A lot of weed. Ice Mocha, a lot of weed. Have Bret Hart walk into a Home Depot.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we're out of that.
Bret just goes, man, you disappointed me, kind of like Bill Goldberg did when he kicked my head in.
Oh, poor Triple H. Poor Triple H.
What's Triple H gonna do?
He'll be fine. This must have been a flock of Canadian geese. What are these birds eating anyway? That they would be shitting that much. And this car that I just cleaned, the windshield had it, the back windshield, the side windows on both sides, the roof, the trunk, the hood, all of it is embarrassing. So fuck the van way, fuck those birds. The past few months have proven anything, it's that this company can survive and even thrive without Vince McMahon sitting in the creative chair. His time has come and gone. For the sake of the company that he built, there's only one thing he needs to do. Stay the fuck away.
The Salamonster sounds off each week, bursting with content, podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Salamonster on Twitter at Salamonster.
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 Salamonster sounds off.